And join us in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Madam Clerk, do we have any changes to our agenda?
There are no changes to today's agenda.
Okay, thank you. That's a rarity. No changes to the agenda, so we will zoom into our consent agenda. And as of now, I have one request to speak. Patricia Gomez, who I just saw. Where are you, Patricia? Oh, there you are. Okay. On A5, please.
Good morning, Supervisors. I'm here to speak on support of Agenda Item A5, and that is a request by the Department of Social Services for a position reallocation. In particular, I am speaking in support of that component, which is to implement the Benefits Advocacy and Resource Connections for Homeless program. I am the director for the Homeless Services Oversight Council, which is your community advisory body on homeless issues, keeping the pulse on the implementation of the 10-year plan to end homelessness here in San Luis Obispo County. The Homeless Services Council has endorsed this program. They support it. And I did send you an email and some informational item regarding programs such as this throughout the country. It is an evidence-based best practice. It is a way that has been proven that will expedite the eligibility for homeless people to become eligible for Social Security income. And that is the first step for many of them towards ending homelessness. It is also a opportunity for the county and many of your contractors to be able to obtain reimbursement for many of the funds that they and you spend for homeless people. So it is a money-generating opportunity for this county, which is why it's so important. I think we were very lucky that the Department of Social Services stepped up to the plate to do this. It's something that's very needed. I do, though, want to point out that they can't do it alone. They'll need the cooperation with a lot of the community-based organizations that you fund and also with your other departments. The health agency, the sheriff's department also stand to gain significant reimbursement funds. And I would urge you to let them know and let your community-based organizations that you fund know that this is a priority. The success of this program will depend upon the collaborative community approach. That's one of the best evidence findings from many of the programs nationwide, that it's when the community and all the agencies that stand to gain collaborate and contribute to the effort that makes it work. So I strongly urge you to let them know that it is a priority for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. If you hold on just a second, I think Supervisor Mitra has a question.
I just wanted to comment, Patricia, your tireless work on this is greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Especially in this economic atmosphere that we find ourselves in, that there's so much more need out there. And I just see you everywhere advocating for this, and I know the board does. We really appreciate your efforts with this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you.
I think we agree. Also on this item, if I can jump in front of you, Mr. Greening, because it's on the same item, Ms. Naylor wants to speak on this, if you please. Jean Naylor.
Good morning, Board of Directors, and thank you for letting me speak. Just briefly, I would be not in favor as a member of the community for eliminating any investigator position from the social services. That's probably one of the most important jobs people have. They get to go out in the field and find out what's really happening. By the time paperwork goes from hand to hand to hand, sometimes facts get misconstrued, and the investigator is the person who is on the ground and has the closest knowledge of facts when it comes to caring for people's families. So thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Mr. Greening on A4, please.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. Good morning. And on A4, this is an amendment to the contract with the Ferguson Group on federal lobbying, and I'm just taking a fresh look under priority projects and issues. Number 10, healthcare reform and efforts to change reform measures. It's not more specific than that. But where we are right now is there are some serious court challenges in progress relative to the individual mandate of what the sort of morass that came out of Washington, D.C. And perhaps what we need to advocate for specifically is states' rights to solve the problem in other ways. And I'm thinking specifically of single payer. I know that federally we're not going to get there. This Congress would never give us single payer. But there might be a coalition of progressives who favor single payer and conservatives who favor states' rights that would move to give states the right to solve their own problem in a more cost-effective way, in which no one would be forced to buy any corporate product, in which the total cost would be considerably less because we wouldn't be carrying 50 different kinds of insurance company paperwork on the backs of a medical system. And so I think perhaps we could specifically direct the Ferguson Group to work toward states' rights on the issue, that as long as a state is going to find a way to cover everyone, they should have the latitude to do so. Vermont is pioneering such an approach right now. And I know that California single payer has gotten very close to enactment. It's gotten through both houses of the legislature and been vetoed a couple of times. So let's keep that doorway open. The other one I want to look at is 23, which is climate change. There are about five items which mention road expansion projects. And finally, we get to 23, and it talks about alternative transportation funding opportunities. I want to be more specific on that. The most urgent is transit system preservation, transit operations. I know that the stimulus crowd wants these big, expensive, high-speed rail projects that might have unaffordable fares in a decade or two. But in the meantime, transit systems all over the country have been hemorrhaging jobs and have been hemorrhaging service. Those are green jobs that can be on the ground now. They don't even need a shovel to be ready for. They just need bodies, hopefully well-paid bodies, to get in those driver's seats and keep public transit available to those who don't drive and those who are the poorest, the disabled, the young, and the old. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. That's the last request I have to speak on consent, so I'm going to close it to consent and bring it back to the board for colleagues' comments on items. Mr. Meacham?
No, sir.
Mr. Gibson?
A little bit more on A5, please, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Teixeira?
No, sir.
And Mr. Patterson?
A comment on A5, please.
Okay, and I'll make a comment on 7. So, Mr. Gibson and then Mr. Patterson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate both Ms. Gomez coming here to talk about that piece that she's been so deeply involved in, and thank her also personally for her work. As I read the staff report, I was really impressed, actually. Social Services is digging in on a number of different issues and looking at how to do things more efficiently and more effectively. And we have the Director of Social Services here, and I was wondering, with your indulgence, we might give him a minute to talk a little bit about the overall program here, because I think it really is the way that county government should be working now to get the job done.
He is sort of shy, but if Mr. Collins would be so kind to address this.
With great reluctance, Mr. Chairman, I approach the podium. Lee Collins, Director of Department of Social Services. Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. We have been working with the Homeless Services Oversight Council and with a much broader group of community advocates and parties to look at this issue of not just the homeless, but a large representation of individuals who are homeless, who appear to have the kind of disability that may qualify them for this federal benefit. It would put some steady income in their pockets from the federal government for which they are qualified, which may enable them to find more secure housing. Certainly, what comes with this is a Medicaid or Medi-Cal card and Medicare that may help them also to have improved access to health care. This is the one thing that providers of homeless services see over and over is this difficulty in accessing medical care, creating chronic health conditions, which can put a drain not only on the county but also on private providers of health insurance, emergency room hospitals, and all of these folks have been represented there. One of the other speakers mentioned the investigator. Now, these are members of our special investigative unit who do fraud investigations, and it's our proposal to eliminate one fraud investigator in no way hints at any interest in reducing our aggressiveness toward uncovering and prosecuting fraud. It's quite the opposite. The problem that we have had is in finding individuals either to apply for the position, to qualify once hired through the post process because they are law enforcement officers, and to keep the job once we have them. We are competing with local law enforcement jurisdictions, the sheriffs, every city's police force in trying to find these folks, and we're not at a competitive level. This is less interesting work, I think, for some who want to go into law enforcement. And so because we developed this paperwork backlog, we have proposed, actually the chief investigator has proposed, this new approach that we can try to see how this works, to have someone process most of the regular paperwork, get that going, and then in a case that suggests the need for further investigation, then one of our two ongoing fraud investigators will pursue that and, when necessary, refer it to the district attorney for prosecution, and we have a good record in that regard. So it is, Supervisor Gibson, clearly a desire on our part to make less work for our partners and primarily to improve the lives of those who are homeless, who have a disability, by ensuring that they get both the therapeutic assistance that they need, the financial assistance, and a more secure living environment. And we did not lead this effort. We are partners in this effort and happy to do whatever we can to assist.
Thanks, sir. Thank you.
I told you he was shy. Thank you, Lee. Yeah.
Thank you. With your permission, I'll return.
You did great, Mr. Collins.
Always appreciated. Thank you. Mr. Patterson, you also wanted to comment on A5?
Well, I don't need to,
okay.
Frankly. I will, but a lot of the substance has already been covered by Ms. Gomez and Lee Collins. I just wanted to thank Lee for bringing this item forward because it does allow our homeless population to be covered for medical and other needs, and at the same time improves the reimbursement to our partners, which includes community health centers, and that was an issue that was raised. So it does meet a need that we currently have, and it's also saving the social services agency some staffing funding and making these position allocations in different categories, and so it saves the department money and improves service and reimbursement. So thanks for bringing that forward.
Okay, thank you. And I just wanted to make a comment at A7 and trying to this is a an authorization for additional bike racks in Avila Beach. This comes from the remainder of some of the Unical settlement money, and I want to thank Ryan Hotstetter from our planning for putting this forward, who herself, you may know, is quite a bike rider or racer, I think. She's competitive. But in Avila, more and more as you go there, and I always encourage you to go there, you see many, many people on bikes and bringing their bikes and being able to put them in these racks so that they can go to the beach or have coffee on the promenade. So we're grateful for Ryan for doing this for our community. And with that, I'll entertain a motion to approve consent.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. If there's no further comments, Madam Clerk, roll call. It's Mr. Meacham, seconded by Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. Appreciate everyone for their comments and for being here. We will now move on to public comment. For items not on the agenda, let me begin with Dane Sensor, followed by Gwen Taylor. Good morning, Mr. Sensor.
My name is Dane Sensor. I've come before this board as a victim's right advocate, a homeless advocate, a veterans advocate, a freedoms advocate, and other issues. I'm an independent thinker. I'm not politically correct. However, I am politically factual. It would be an honor to have the acknowledgement of being the Michael Savage of Slo County. They call him crazy, hostile, insane, and is banned from England. People in this county call me the same. However, I haven't been banned from any country yet. I am, however, banned from the talk show, quote, the freedom of speech segment morning show of the right-wing station KPLR at 12:30 a.m. Well, you're saying, what has this have to do with the county's business today? I never thought by speaking at a public comment city council meeting in Atascadero, asking them to honor the 21 veteran Navy SEALs from Navy 6 who were killed in action, I never thought that this county, who officially made the memorial Faces of Freedom, would turn into such a controversy. I was slandered, told I was belonged in Atascadero State Hospital. I was told I need counseling, I need medication. My family was even told that I was escorted out of public comment in the city of Atascadero. All are completely false statements. Al Fonzie spoke over the airwaves that this memorial is only for county veterans only. I asked this county to clarify, if an out-of-state family buys a $100 brick on the Freedom Path with the name of its loved one on it that live in another state, should that brick be removed and should that honorable veteran's family be given back the $100? Individual counsels, Roberta Fonzie, KPLR, went as far as to have me falsely arrested, case number 11-2134, to discredit me. I asked this board today in charge, who is in charge of the Faces of Freedom Memorial, Veterans Memorial? This county, Atascadero City Council, or the foundation? And as far as me being crazy, insane, hostile, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I have an impeccable clean record, and I have no less than 30 letters and an article in the New Times today, an honorable paper, I might say, and I want to make it for the county record as I will submit this today. Anyone's welcome to read it, anybody in the public also. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sensor. Gwen Taylor, followed by Derek Bishop. Morning.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I am a resident of Los Osos, including the Prohibition Zone. This board has approved numerous financing arrangements for the Los Osos Sewer Project, borrowing from the general fund, borrowing from the road fund, receiving grant funds, paying back the general fund, cost sharing for development of the Basin Master Plan, amendments to the existing agreements with engineering firms, cost sharing of legal representatives under memorandums of understanding to the ISJ. The above and numerous additional financial juggling begs for a forensic audit under the rules and procedures of accounting. With all the firewalls of internal audit, proactive fraud, components of prevention, dedication, as well as deterrence. Assembly Bill 1125 that is supposed to help low-income families with their sewer costs prohibits the county and or the CSD district from financing the proposed program using ratepayers' funds. This loan proposal is supposed to be funded by using federal and state grants. Many times, federal and state grants have conditions associated with them. When used, they should benefit all the assessment district to their maximum. These monies should be used to reduce not only the overall cost, but the interest that is adds on to the monthly costs for everyone. This loan proposal also brings into question the public works and the grant financing. Is this the money from the USDA for disadvantaged communities grant funds to be used for the whole community, since we have been designated as a disadvantaged community under the USDA revised criteria, or are just those that fall under whatever criteria the county establishes for low income? This is not just, it is not fair, and it surely is not democratic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Bishop, followed by Ben DeFatta.
Good morning.
Morning.
I thank you all for your public service. I talk to you today with a heavy heart. I don't like washing your dirty linen in public. I'm a taxpayer. I live in the city of San Luis Obispo within the county of San Luis Obispo. I have, at the moment, grave concerns with a county department situated at 3,433 South Higuera. I believe this department is overseen by the Board of Supervisors and county staff. My latest encounter with the HR section is a classic example of what I believe is a dysfunctional department. I was told to access the county website and do my own research. Okay, I'll play their game. I went along to my local library, because I can't afford access myself, to find it closed due to budget cuts. I trust the library director and all of his staff were away from their posts and not drawing a salary. I believe that County Social Services at 3433 South Higuera is overseen by the Board of Supervisors and county staff. In my opinion, it needs investigation. There is a fraud investigation section on site. I don't expect a common sense answer from that department to my constructive comments, as all involved will be too busy doing their jobs. My name is Derek Bishop. My social security number is 606-580-444. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Lindy Owen. Morning, Ben.
Morning, Chairman Hill, Board, Public Sheriff. Ben DeFatta from Gibson's District 2, soon to be homeless, bankrupt zone of Los Osos. Citizens of Los Osos request a federal investigation of actions by Supervisor Gibson, Public Works Director, Public Ogren, and his staff. In the last 10 years, you have heard many comments and suggestions from the public to you and your predecessors that all were to the good. A track record now exists that shows Gibson and Ogren's wrongdoings that has cost the property owners approximately $12 million doing just the same studies after studies after studies, all because of Gibson and Ogren's stubbornness of insisting that only an expensive, unaffordable, flawed big pipe, deep trench, liquefaction, stinking gravity collection project to be built in the Los Osos sand dune. Even after Montgomery Watson Harza has been scolded by the Construction Management Association of America, Gibson and Aubrey are still considering that Montgomery Watson Harza be the only bidder to build this costly gravity collection system. A summary of the claims were that, quote, Montgomery Watson Harza failed to objectively and ethically evaluate wastewater treatment system alternatives, overcharge or double charge the district on several occasions, should not have competed for the design phase of the project because as the project manager it had a conflict of interest, and that it had improperly recommended pre-qualified bidders for subcontracts and accepted subcontract bids that were higher than the estimates for self-serving reasons, end quote. Now, if that doesn't say enough to kick Montgomery Watson Harza out of ever bidding in this county again, then you're not doing your job of stopping them. What is it that you insist to keep spending Los Osos deeper in debt? Wasting public funds is a crime. I remind you that Montgomery Watson has a dismal record, like I mentioned above, in some states that they are in court on, the new one being Austin, Texas. They have the same MO everywhere they do business. Somebody will go to jail when a federal investigation is completed. In the meantime, stop this project till we have a fair evaluation of low pressure and vacuum systems evaluated also. Auburn has Los Osos new general manager Bruce Buell backdate a contract that went from $95 million to $145 million even after the project got started. Pillow talk with your whiz kid Auburn with CSD Director Maria Kelly, where she was on every committee that had anything to do with the county. Ever notice she was an expert at
Thank
everything?
You, Ben. Your time's up. We'll see you soon. Miss Owen, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from the bizarre sewer world of Los Osos. I wanted to begin by asking Mr. Grant how the investigation into the four-year private personal relationship and affair between Public Works Director Pava Ogren and ex-vice president of the Los Osos Community Services District, how is that investigation going? As usual, I'm worried that it would be like the last investigation, which basically died a slow death of just ignoring it long enough for it to kind of go away. I think it's extremely important. I'd like to know what the influence this relationship had on the now five-year, $8 million plus and rising, non-competitive direction that the Montgomery Watson Harza tainted sewer design project has taken. How much waste. It's just shameful. And Maria Kelly and Pava Ogren's relationship had a huge amount to do with this.
Ms. Owen, could you direct your comments to the chair, please? Thank you.
You want me to look at you?
If you would.
Sorry,
direct
it's
your
just it's
the
a
chair.
Private joke. We need an outside investigation, just as with David Edge and Gail Wilcox. You can't investigate yourself. This is way too deep, and I think you have to get that started as soon as possible. Again, as the prior speaker spoke, it looks like Montgomery Watson Harza's in trouble again. They just keep leaving legal battles behind them wherever they go. Now it's Austin, Texas. I wanted to just also commend Ed Oakes and TheRockOfTheCoast.com is a great website to go to start seeing some of the information that doesn't come out in our Tribune. He is saying, his comment is, having laid waste to homeowners in Cape Coral, flim-flammed the city of New Orleans, and a threat to do both in Los Osos and the sister city of Morro Bay on California's Central Coast, Montgomery Watson Harza has targeted Austin, where the city has contracted the Bloomfield Colorado-based global infrastructure firm to build a $500 million-plus water treatment plant that has boondoggle written all over it. What we could be doing is putting in a step collection system that would collect the lower-lying area of Los Osos, get through an earthquake with absolutely no problem. If it broke, it would leak pre-treated liquid. It could go out for treatment, and we could also set up an incinerator to take all the septage pumpings state-of-the-art incinerator, and we could actually provide a service for the county that the county does not provide for itself, which is handling sludge. It now goes outside the county, and there's no place within the county to handle it. Los Osos could be a project that you'd be proud of instead of continuing on with this disgusting mess that you've allowed to continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Greening, followed by Richard Margetson.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. And despite the important controversy that lingers over the whether the Carrizo is an appropriate place for large-scale solar production, I think there is probably consensus in the county that solar production in the built environment makes sense to whatever extent we can achieve it. And I would like to broaden that discussion. When we talk solar production, we're not just talking about the installation of panels. The actual form of the buildings and the form of the built environment can be productive or not, depending how much thought goes into it. In that connection, I'd like to announce an event this Saturday evening at the Steinberg Gallery, 6 p.m. David Bainbridge and Ken Haggard will be having an event to release their new book, Passive Solar Architecture. And you may have seen some of Mr. Haggard's other books. He has a wonderful architectural history of this county, which should be in the hands of every planner, certainly. And a wonderfully dense book called Fractal Architecture that looks at the entire span of human history, as well as very specifically at some planning and architectural possibilities and how they can express nature's resonances. I look forward to this new book because it's going to hopefully open a dialogue that will influence our own county's climate action plan and our own county's way of looking at solving the problems of habitation in an ecologically sensitive way. We don't have to choose between escalating consumption and freezing in the dark. We can choose to shrink our ecological footprint without freezing in the dark, without a crimped feeling lifestyle, by using time-honored and innovative methods in an artful combination. And these methods aren't just something that should inform the new things that are built. There are potentials for retrofitting the existing built environment. So we have an opportunity this Saturday at 6 at the Steinberg Gallery, Monterey, just above California, to enter into a discussion with like-minded people from all points of view and have some creative ferment and get in our hands a good advice manual for how to move forward from here. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, and thanks for calling that to our attention. Saturday at 6 at Steinberg Gallery. Ken Haggard's a good architect and scholar in our community. Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson. First comment is about Assembly Bill 1125. I'm going to read from an article in the Bay News. Will Clemens, from your Public Works Department, stated that we plan to model the program after what is already in place for the gas company, PG&E, and the telephone. They usually give typically a 20% discount. If this legislation is to maximize the impact or reduce the impact for low-income and disadvantaged citizens in Los Osos, giving a 20% discount on their monthly bill, which will be eventually put on the property tax rolls because you're not going to get a bill in the mail, is not the most efficient way of using these funds. If you want to reduce the impact to the low-income portion of Los Osos, the first avenue should be to try to get as many sewer connections from the property to the street done with this money. Because in your breakdown of costs,
of the original 200 to 250, $40 to $50 of that monthly cost, if it was broken out monthly, was for doing your lateral connections. If the homeowner financed it over 10 years at 8, 9% on a personal or equity loan on their property. 20% reduction on your rates and charges is not $40 to $50. And I think you get more bang for the buck if you get $3 million, $5 million, whatever. I think you can do a lot of lateral connections with that money, which will have a more substantial impact on the community than reducing the monthly bill 20%. If you're not going to do it that way, if you're not going to go that direction, then you should take the money off the top. It's less money we have to pay back, and it saves on the interest charges over 40 years, which are going to be substantial. My last comment deals with, we have not heard a response, and I think you could probably stop the questions here at the microphone, Mr. Grant, if we had some indication of when the Maria Kelly Pablo Ogun situation is going to be addressed by this board. Karen Veeley from Cal Coast News is not going to let up on this until she gets some satisfaction from either this board, the Tribune, or you know some other news agency you know, looking into this. There are some issues. I not for having the family part of this issue, but I think we need some answers.
Thank you, Mr. Margeson.
Thank you.
That will close it for public comment and bring it back to the board. I see no comments. So, Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our first hearing item of the morning.
Item C1, a hearing to consider the options to adjust the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors district boundaries and select one option to be incorporated in the ordinance for adoption in a subsequent public hearing pursuant to Elections Code Sections 21500 through 21506.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Good morning. Jim Grant, County Administrator. Chairman, members of the board, I'm joined here with Leslie Brown from the Administrative Office and John Kelly from our Planning Office to provide an overview of the redistricting process that we've been involved in for quite some time. Today, this really is our first public hearing on redistricting, and so we're going to, but it's far from the first time we've talked about this. As a matter of fact, we started this process in late February and discussed with the board what redistricting was, the legal requirements, the process involved, and the timelines for completion of that. And from there, staff went out and held three public workshops, one in the north, one here centrally, and then one in the south county as well. In addition, we attended two city council meetings in San Luis Obispo and in Paso Robles. So we have been taking a lot of public comment over the last number of months to ensure that we had the best fair and open process that we could to get information about this redistricting process. And we also came back to your board in July to talk about what we found, and then the board did review four options at that time and whittled it down to two options, which were option B and C. So today we are back and we're doing a public hearing, the first public hearing of two public hearings, and hopefully we will have your board again consider options B and C. There is another option B1 that you'll hear about a little bit later, and an option C1 that we'll talk about a little bit later as well. If your board is interested in seeing those, we can show those. So the idea today is we're going to cover some ground that we've already covered before, but I think it's important because we're having a public hearing to, go over the legal requirements, the census data, the public involvement, and then reviewing the options. So it will seem like you've heard this before, and if it sounds like that, it's because you've heard it many times before, but I think, again, we need to go through that just because it is a public hearing. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Leslie, and we're going to try to move as fast as we can through that since we have covered that ground before. Thank you, Leslie.
Okay. So as we indicated on February 22nd and July 19th, the elections, California Elections Code sections 21,500 through 21,506 requires our county to redraw the supervisorial district boundaries every 10 years following the census. And these new boundaries need to be in place by November 1st. And if this is not accomplished, then a redistricting commission that's comprised of the district attorney who would serve as the chair, the county assessor, and the county elections official would need to enact a redistricting plan by the end of the calendar year, December 31st. The primary purpose of redistricting is to rebalance the population of the five districts and to make them as equal in count as possible, to bring the districts back into compliance with the one-person, one-vote mandate of the Constitution. Federal and state law also requires compliance with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which mandates that a redistricting plan not be discriminatory against racial or language minorities in either purpose or effect, even if this is unintended. And as I've mentioned before, this has been really the focus of a lot of legal cases in the past. Finally, state law requires a minimum of two hearings, the first, which we are holding today, the purpose of which would be for the board to consider various options before voting on an ordinance, and then the second, to adopt the ordinance that would put that board-selected plan into effect. And as we'll be pointing to later, we are hoping to set that for September 6th. While the balancing of the population of the districts is the primary consideration or goal of redistricting, there are secondary considerations that can be taken into account. They are listed here on this slide. I did include definitions of those in the staff report, so I won't run through those again, but essentially topography, geography, cohesiveness, contiguity, integrity, compactness of territory, and communities of interest. And our staff did take these factors into account where possible. Just a review again of what the census data told us. The total county population is approximately 269,600. However, your board directed us to remove the inmate or state prison population from that count, consistent with the state attorney general's decision back in 1991. We also did this in 2000. So you'll note that these first two columns here are adjusted population numbers because we did that in 2000. So we're comparing apples to apples. You'll note that there's a total population growth of about 24,400 or about 10%. And most of the change has occurred in the North County in District 1 and in the South County in District 4, although there has been growth in all four districts. And the actual difference in population now between the most populous district and the least populous is about 18%, which shows that we really need to rebalance the population. And this chart just shows the changes that need to occur if we were to rebalance the population so that each district had the same number of residents. And, for example, District 1 needs to actually lose about 5,500 people. District 2 needs to gain about 21, 22,000 people, et cetera. So Mr. Grant went through a lot of what we've already done in terms of public involvement, and so I won't repeat that. We have been maintaining the website, posting the maps, and taking down old maps as they are discarded through the process, et cetera. And we have been receiving some emails just of late with some people indicating what their preferences are in terms of what they would like the board to do today. This is a slide that shows the existing districts with, let's see if I can get my arrow to work here, District 1 in the North County, represented by Supervisor Meacham. District 2 is the North Coast and extends down to the western part of San Luis Obispo, represented by Supervisor Gibson. District 3 is represents a large chunk of San Luis Obispo, as well as Avila Beach, Pismo Beach, Grover Beach. District 4 is the South County district that includes Arroyo Grande, Oceano, Napomo. And then District 5 starts up in the North County, representing Atascadero, Santa Margarita, Pozo area, and then extends all the way down through the Carrizo Plain to the southeastern border of the county. And now we'll go through the options. Option B, and I will ask you to try and guide the arrows here as I go through the description of each of these. So option B, in this option, the entire area of the Templeton Community Services District and Urban Reserve Line is kept together in District 1. The area that is west of Templeton, south of Highway 46, down to Vineyard Drive, and along the Templeton Community Services District boundary would move from District 1 to District 2. There's about 370 people in that area. And the border for District 5 would extend north of its current boundary along Highway 41, but would remain south of Highway 46, west of the Shannon Community Advisory Council boundaries, and outside of the Paso Robles City fringe area. There's approximately 4,300 people in this area. And I should note that the community of Shannon would remain in District 1 in this option. District 3 would extend east and south along Orchid Road down to Lopez Drive, shifting approximately 1,300 people from District 4 into District 3. And the southeastern border of District 4 would extend east along the Highway 166 corridor, shifting about 130 people from District 5 to District 4. Next slide. This slide shows the detail, so you can see that the dotted line is the entire Templeton Community Services District, and URL area is kept in District 1. In San Luis Obispo area, the Cal Poly student housing that's currently in District 5 would shift to District 2, so District 2 would have the entire Cal Poly student housing area. The Cal Poly campus core would remain in District 5. District 4 would pull out of the city of San Luis Obispo entirely, so that would shift about 1,300 people into District 3. The area near Andrew Street and San Luis Drive would move from District 3 to District 5. The area east of Tassajara Drive and south of Foothill Boulevard would move to District 2, or from District 2 to District 5, and there is about 900 people there. The residential area south of Madonna Road, east of Los Osos Valley Road, and west of the Delidio and Target properties would shift almost 970 people from District 3 to District 2. And then District 3 would gain about 2,700 people from District 2 in the area south of Los Osos Valley Road and east of Perfumo Canyon Road. Okay, next slide. And this is option C. As noted up in the corner in tiny lettering, this was formally labeled option F when we were looking at all of the options. This is the option that we developed with a resident of Templeton who is a member of the Templeton Advisory Group at his request. This option keeps the entire Templeton School District together within District 1. And in order to give District 5 the population it needs, the northern boundary of that district would have to extend north up to the southern city of Paso Robles border, and then northeasterly to Highway 46 East. This would bisect Whitley Gardens and go to the western boundary of the Shannon Community Advisory Council. There's approximately 4,600 people in that area. A portion of the rural eastern Paso Robles City fringe area would remain in District 1. And similar to Option B, District 3 extends south along Orchid Road and Lopez Drive. And then the southeastern border of District 4 would extend along the Highway 166 corridor. Next slide. And again, this is a detail slide. On the left-hand side, you can see where the boundary lines would be drawn between District 1 and District 5, with District 5 coming close up to the city of Paso Robles. Similar to Option B in San Luis, which is on the right-hand side of the slide, Cal Poly student housing would shift from District 5 to District 2. District 4 would pull out of the San Luis Obispo city limits. Almost 850 people would transfer from District 5 to District 2 in the area west of Broad Street and extending south to Highway 101 to Madonna Road. And again, District 3 would gain about 2,700 people from District 2 in the area south of Los Osos Valley Road and east of Profumo Canyon. And then a key difference here is about 1,500 in population would shift from District 3 to District 5 and the downtown areas between Marsh and Pismo Streets down to Highway 101 and in the neighborhood areas east of Johnson Avenue to Bishop Street and Andrew Street.
I should make note that at this point in time, on July 19th, there were four options the board looked at. There was A, B, C, and D options. You discarded A and D, left with us with B and C, but B was the preferred option at that time. C was left in as a second place, basically. That evening, we did travel to Paso Robles and met with the city council and discussed and shared with them these options B and C. And B was their preferred option as well over C. So it's I just wanted to make the board aware of that. So B was the preferred option from the city of Paso. And so we're bringing this back again. These have not changed from when the options that you saw that had seen on July 19th. But since then, again, I'll just say that one of the supervisors, Supervisor Meacham, had asked for a modified B to be developed, and the residents of Templeton had asked for a modified C to be developed as well. So those are options. If your board is interested in looking at those, it's option B1 and option C1. So we'll kick it back to your board now, I think, for discussion. Is that right, Leslie?
Right, and there's one more point I'd like to make, is we did receive a letter from the Chamber of Commerce in Templeton just yesterday that referenced option B3. I think we're confusing people by relabeling things, and we're trying to keep it straight. But B3 is now B1 for today. Okay, so just to wrap up my part of the presentation, the recommendations we have are to discuss the redistricting options B and C, and if you choose, the modified B1 and C1, which I have yet to reveal. The goal is to select one redistricting option and then direct staff to prepare an ordinance that would reflect this option. It's basically a legal written description of the option. We would introduce that and the next hearing on August 23rd, which means we'll need to submit a core agenda item this week. And that item will request that the board set the second hearing for a vote on the ordinance on September 6th. And then finally, we're asking that the board authorize the county clerk recorder to use the alternative publication procedure, which would essentially be a summary of the ordinance and a map as opposed to publishing the entire legal written description. And that concludes my presentation.
And we turn it back to the board for discussion.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if the board would entertain that, I would like to have the B1 and C1 presented so that we can have an idea what we're looking at before the public weighs in on this. I did spend a couple hours up at the advisory council's meeting in Templeton to hear what the community's trying to accomplish here. And if memory serves correctly, I think that the advisory council supported the option of B1. So I'd like to have those presented, if I could, before we get public comment, so that they can, everybody out here can see exactly what we're proposing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I certainly support taking a look at those. I have had an opportunity to discuss both of them with residents of the Houston area, and so I think it is appropriate that we at least take a look at them.
Okay. Ms. Brown,
okay.
Please.
Okay, this is option, excuse me, B1, and you'll notice the key difference here between this and option B would be District 5 would come in and take this, we're calling it a fox head, but it's the western the western part of Templeton that had been in District 2 in option B. So about 370 people would shift into District 5 from District 1 in this option. There are no changes in San Luis Obispo area. This is the only real change here. And I did include detail slides just to show that. And option C1 was a modification that we worked on with the member of the Templeton Advisory Committee in response to what was heard at the Paso Robles City Council meeting on July 19th. And there were some revisions made. You'll note that District 5 boundary does not extend up to Highway 46 as it did in Option C, and also there's a more of a buffer around the city limits in the boundary lines between District 1 and District 5. What this does is moves the eastern portion of the Templeton School District area up to the Salinas River into District 5. So the Templeton School District area would then be represented by two districts instead of just one, which was the case in Option C. And I think that's really the essence. The key change here, too, is that the border of District 5 would extend across this way all the way to the eastern boundary, and this would actually divide the Shandon Community Advisory Committee area, which we do not have actually showing on this slide, but that is something that we could show if need be.
And in terms of the insets, if we looked at those, I believe that there is no change in terms of the insets for San Luis Obispo that is any different than the option C itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we have for those, and we can entertain any questions you might have.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brown, the difference, because I noticed on here it says formerly option F. We had option C, C1, and formerly option F. Can you give me just quickly the change between C1 and F?
Now it's C1 and C. So F was what we used when we had all of our seven options
under
consideration. On July 19th, we relabeled them.
Let me cut to the chase here. C, option F is C now.
Yeah.
This actually, where it says formally option F should be taken off from here. It's
okay.
A mistake for C1.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for staff before we open up to the public? Okay. We'll come back to that. So we will open it up to the public for comment on this, and we'll begin with James Wood, followed by Jeff DeBrisch, please. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is James Wood. I'm with the Templeton Action Committee. We're a group of Templeton residents, and we feel strongly that Templeton needs to stay in one supervisory district. We've been following closely as most of our compatriots have in Templeton, the issue as it goes along, and Templeton has expressed its strong opinion that we belong in one district, not divided between two or three. And as I see the process go along, what I see coming from the supervisors is division in every case. And since that's the case, the only conclusion that I can come to is that it's a political decision, not a demographic decision. And I think that is exceedingly unfortunate. Templeton wants to remain in one district. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. DeBrisch, followed by Gene Ayler.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question. If you were all in separate rooms right now, could you conduct your business real well? Probably not. And that's one of the things that Templeton has a unique ability to conduct their business right now, but dividing everything up, I think that would hinder what they do. It is a unique area. And I think the option that has been presented, option C or C1, would be the options that definitely have to be considered more, I would hope. And we'd like to keep our school district in one area if we can, and possibly that can work out, and our community services district. And as far as the numbers portion, that option C keeps your numbers well into what you need. I understand it's a 10% legal thing, and 2% is what you were shooting for. Option C keeps it at just over 1%. So I'd say that works pretty well. So, gentlemen, I would ask that you please reconsider option C. I think it's a good compromise for everybody. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Naylor, followed by Robert Rosales.
Good morning again. This is the last thing I'm going to speak on today. And I'm new to the whole issue of redistricting. I'm finding it very confusing. But when I did look at the paperwork a couple of weeks ago, I did get the impression that was similar to your first speaker, that there seemed to be a divisive quality about some of the particular plans. If you have to consider cohesiveness, compactness of interest in geography as something to consider, living in Oceano, I also have property in Cambria, but the first plan, whatever it's called, Plan B, seems to push me living in Oceano, it seems to push Oceano interests more east and more south. And in the next election, we're going to be deciding not just making national decisions, but for the South County, very important decisions about what they're going to do with their water. Water, sewer, flooding is important, especially along the coast. So to take San Luis Obispo residents, because if I understand this correctly, District 4 does include parts of San Luis Obispo, to take that population away, which I think is a good mix for District 4, and then, add population from the east, I think that kind of divisive on particular issues about what the coastal cities are going to do, and those considerations and issues that are coming up in the next election. I was going to say one other thing, and I can't remember what I was going to say. Also, Oceano, I just found out yesterday from your elections division that even though we've got approximately 7,000 or more people, and we've grown considerably, only half of that population, only about 3,000 people, are voters. And, my idea of an ideal community is a mix of people coming from different stratas, different cultures, different educational backgrounds, and you know, one half can educate the other half. So if you can't make a decision, why can't we just keep it the way it is? Or do we have to redistrict? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Naylor. Mr. Rosales, followed by Bill Pelfrey.
Good morning. Rob Rosales, speaking as a resident and private resident of Templeton, even though I know I've met with a few of you on behalf of the Templeton Chamber of Commerce. I'd just like to say that I hope you do take into consideration the alternatives that have been presented today. They go more in line with to address some of the concerns that were expressed at the previous meeting. With regard to that, I would support the feeling that was here on July 19th in support of option B. I would concedingly support B1, the alternative there. I feel it is less significant ripple effect and is more incremental, which are both stated desires of this board. It divides Templeton into two districts rather than three, using a geographical, urban, and rural areas of our community. And there is no, I see no need to actually split us into three without any justification. You look at this as in two districts, it's more incremental, as I said, less ripple effect. When looking at compactness or cohesiveness and communities of interest, keeping as much of Templeton together as possible, I think one satisfies the needs and concerns, and also there is no, I should say, with regard to two versus three, the 370 people that would be affected by that, it is insignificant when it comes to the margin of population variance. You're going from 2.9% to 3.6%, which I believe is insignificant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rosales. Mr. Pelfrey, followed by Eric Greening.
Mr. Chair, before you start my time, may I correct something on your report?
It's sure.
For planning staff. On page C1, page 4, on districts where you have variance, 4 and 5, the signs should be swapped. The District 4 should be a negative, and District 5 should be a positive. Did you find it? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bill Pelfrey. Well, I'm that citizen from Templeton, D.C. and C1. Let me explain to you what happened on C1, because I do advocate for C. That is what every resident I've spoken to in Templeton is for. I did C1 after the meeting in Paso Robles. Now, except for staff, I'm the only person here that has attended all four meetings. Paso Robles was very upset about intruding on what area they hope to incorporate. Now, I went back to the staff and worked C1 as a compromise. But I'm not advocating it right at this moment for one reason, and that is that people of Templeton want to stay whole. Now, we are one town, the only town, in that school district. And 20 years ago, this board saw fit to make TAG boundaries the school district because they saw us as cohesive and a community that desired to be the same. Now, if you're going to consider Paso Robles, what did he call it? The natural sphere of influence as influential in your decision. What about Templeton's natural sphere of influence? You're cutting out 25% of our population that live outside the URL. Our URL hasn't grown with the people. Your Plan B divides Vineyard Drive, does not take into account one side of Vineyard Drive. In fact, part of the east side, you're dividing neighbor upon neighbor. A couple of them, you go right through their property, and it changes. There's something wrong here. Now, to answer some of the questions from last time, in your examples, I believe it was Mr. Patterson that gave some examples about supervisorial districts' impact on other communities, and yet you cited City of Atascadero and San Luis Obispo. They have their own internal governments. We don't. We have you. We are asking you to look for out for us. They have their own building and planning and everything else. We need you to keep us whole. That's what we want. That's what the citizens of Templeton want. That's what they advocate for. Now, B doesn't take into account Hidden Valley, which is west of our URL. B1 doesn't take into account the Evers Ball Field, which is between the Salinas and the URL, the proposed new water treatment plant, or the housing that's been there for decades. Option C, I made after all the input and took everybody into account, all the unincorporated areas. It's the only one that does.
Thank you, Mr. Pelfrey. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and first I'd like to thank you for discarding A and D. I prefer either or both of the C's to either or both of the B's, and I'll get into a little more on that, on why. But I have a question about a possible modification of C1, because I do think Paso Robles raises some significant concerns, so I have a slight leaning in that direction. But one concern I do have, if the adjustment were made between 1 and 5 with a C1 to keep the Shandon Advisory Committee area whole, how many people would be affected, and would that be within our reasonable margins? If you can move 378 people between B and B1 without compensating elsewhere along that boundary, I have a feeling we're moving fewer people if we keep Shandon whole, but otherwise go with C1. The advantage of C and C1 that hasn't been much talked about, because all the discussion has been around Templeton and Paso Robles, is in the city of San Luis Obispo, Pismo makes a much more coherent boundary between 3 and 5 than Marsh does. Marsh more or less bisects the downtown area. And between Marsh and Pismo, you're getting into a mixed-use area that is more or less a continuation of the downtown. Yes, there are residences, but there are also major retail, such as the Scolari Center. There are numerous churches. There are numerous nonprofits. There are government agencies, such as LAFCO, sprinkled in with the residences. And then when you get to Pismo, you're getting into more or less a coherent residential district that starts with Old Town and continues. So it simply makes sense to me that since the District 5 has much of the downtown area, that line at Pismo is a better feature for both C and C1. And I don't have enough information to know exactly where you balance the concerns of keeping the Templeton sphere of influence whole versus keeping the Paso expansion area whole, but I would like to think that there might be some tweak that would give a little bit more of the Templeton-Paso dispute area to District 5 in exchange for keeping the Shandon area whole in District 1. So I would like to think that there might be a modified C1, and that C1 might be the best starting place, addressing some of the concerns raised by Mr. Pelfrey relative to Templeton, but not stepping too much on the concerns raised by Paso Robles and keeping the Shandon Advisory Committee area whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. And that's all I have for public comment on this item. So we'll close it to public comment, bring it back to the board. Yes, Mr.
Comment, if you don't mind.
Please.
Jim Grant, County Administrator. Just a couple of things based on the comments that we've heard here.
Mm-hmm.
About one, do we need to redistrict? And the answer is yes, we need to rebalance the population within the supervisorial districts. And we know that District 1 has 5,560 folks, too many basically, to get it back into balance. So we do need to work up in that area. Second, you okay with that? Second comment is I just want to make sure that the board and the public is aware that in these options that we've presented,
the community of Templeton is kept whole in terms of their community services district and the urban reserve line. Those are not split. Those have remained whole. What is being split in these is the school district. And as we discussed in the prior meeting in July, school districts are split. They're split here in the San Luis area. They're split down south. So I just want to point out that that is not an unusual factor in the supervisorial districts. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll bring it back to the board for deliberations. Mr. Meacham.
I have a question, and I don't know if you can do this very quickly at all, but Mr. Green raises some really interesting points. In regard to the population area, if you were to do a modified C1 that would allow for Shandon to remain whole, I don't know what kind of numbers we're looking at in that regard.
It's going to be up to the board to determine if they want to start negotiating numbers right now. So before we pull that up, we'll let the board weigh in.
Mr. Gibson?
I saw Mr. Patterson possibly with a comment, since it does involve D5, I'd go there. Myself, I think we have a range of options on the table, and we should pick one of them and move this on.
Let's move this on. I appreciate, and we've read, I think we've gotten some emails, particularly form emails, over the last day, and I appreciate even some of the comments. I went to all of the public meetings that staff held in parts of the county, and certainly have spoken with some folks, including last week from Templeton. And I understand the concern that they express. I mean, part of the situation, of course, is just practical. We need to redistrict, and we need to balance it in a way that adheres to the guidelines. And there's just some practical, issues, such as the fact that the biggest population center is in the center of the county, and that's San Luis Obispo, the city. Some of the statements about dividing Templeton and how it would have such an effect, that it seems to me to sort of run counter to logic on some levels. But a big part of our job is to promote and to inspire a greater sense of county solidarity and more collaboration and cooperation. That's why the board sits on all the regional boards. That's why we have continued to push forward in a variety of ways, including in our tourism, which is, if you were to Google wine and coast San Luis Obispo, you'll come to our VCB site. I guess part of my concern is, we should always be doing what we can to strengthen the social and economic and even political attachments and encourage cohesiveness over factionalism, because I have heard quite a lot of sort of political factionalism, and I don't really think we want to cater to some sense of regional estrangement that somehow San Luis is this or Templeton is that, some sort of ideological division. I don't think that that's really what our seats are created to do. I think that's something that we need to always overcome, really. And there's already supervisorial districts that do, mine included, that do bring in a variety of different cities and towns. And it's really up to the individual supervisor to be able to provide the best representation as possible for those places. And I don't really think that that's something that's particularly difficult. And I appreciate Supervisor Meacham's effort to come up with another option that some people favor, but seems overwhelmingly from the emails we got, at least, that people were favoring the C. I don't favor C. I think the ripple effect is much greater. The one that I favor, B, is the one that was developed by staff, and I think that, again, developed by staff, the justification is just practical. It's just trying to balance the numbers with the least amount of ripple effect, and also trying to preserve, at least in Templeton, as far as they're concerned, their CSD area, their boundaries. And the other one, which changes a bit, is an option developed by one of the supervisors. So I think even if you're looking at it on face value, one seems to be freer of any any of the concerns expressed by people here or people expressed in other meetings about, or expressed in other, for instance, at the state and national level, other redistricting issues which has to do with politics. So that's what I have to say so far, and I'll go to Supervisor Patterson, Supervisor Gibson, and others.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to emphasize that there's an ongoing debate about what's Templeton. You know, what defines Templeton in terms of the geographic area. Some folks are saying it's a school district, yet the proposals before us do impact the school district. And currently in the districts that are configured currently, I actually do have part of my school district represented by District 1, and I in turn represent through my Creston Advisory Council areas that are in District 1, and that was an agreement that I established with former Supervisor Ovid, because the people who live north of Highway 41 in the Creston area, they actually consider themselves as Creston residents, even though they are in District 1, and that's worked out very well. And in Option B, that area would actually come into a new District 5. A lot of those folks encompassed in Option B to the north and further to the east of the Salinas River that would come into 5, many of those folks along Creston Road consider themselves Creston residents, even though they are in the Templeton School District. And we have made a concerted effort to keep Templeton whole as it's currently governed by the TAG, the Templeton Advisory Committee, as well as the CSD Board. The Urban Reserve Line and the Templeton Community Services District area is represented by that board, and that stays whole. And actually, I think that Templeton in Option B actually improves the representation on the Board of Supervisors rather than dilutes it. And I've had that conversation with representatives of Templeton, some of whom support Option B and B1, and some of whom support C and C1. So there's debate in the Templeton community as to what best defines Templeton and which option is best. And I think given the issues that I've just mentioned and my experience representing the rural areas where the community definition is sort of grayed, do they live in Templeton, do they live in Creston, depends on the individual. For those reasons, I support Option B. I think it's the best proposal. It does keep Templeton whole in terms of their urban reserve line and their CSD boundaries, and I think that's really what the Templeton community looks at as their definitive boundaries.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there are a lot of ways that we can draw these lines, and through a lot of hard work by staff and members of the public and ponderings of this board, we've come down to a couple. You know, I would say that all of them have minor pros and cons relative to various communities. Some of those communities are here speaking, or one of those communities is here speaking, and other communities that might be affected by alternatives aren't. I rewind to July 19th when we considered this before. I think there was near consensus on this board that option B was the preferred. It was certainly one that all five of us indicated should be brought forward for consideration today. You know, as I listen to testimony today and as I review emails that have come in and conversations that I've had with members of the Templeton community, I think there's a range of opinions within Templeton as to what you know, what option might be preferred. I don't see a clear consensus. TAG has one idea, Mr. Pelfrey and others. So we're left, I think, to analyze these things on their merits. And I guess the matrix that I run in my head is that we started with two coming out of our last meeting, and I think quite clearly option B is superior to option C between the movement of the in option C of District 5 very far north, the approached close to the Paso city limits. I think that that was clearly suboptimal relative to what B had would put on the table. I look at C1 as a tweak on C that doesn't get it very far, causes a lot of the same sorts of issues. And similarly, I look at B1 as a tweak on B that moves a few people between districts. But as I look at the maps, the area that's really being affected there, I think could go either way. It's largely very low density rural residential areas in the hills, very similar, frankly, to the area that I live in, out of the coastal zone. I think there's a lot of similar concerns about a variety of things that this board has to deal with. I think then by that process of elimination through the matrix that option B being more balanced than option B1 is the one that I endorse. Our staff had tried to work with that primary issue of balance here. They had started with a 2% variance target. They relaxed that slightly to 3%. And I think within that, I don't think we are justified in relaxing to 10%. That as I talked to council about that, that doesn't make sense. And so all things whole, I think that option B is one that we've talked about a lot. I think it's one that we can put into ordinance to be introduced and acted on September 6th. Again, I very much appreciate your comments about the need for a continuity, a collaborative approach, a spirit of being one county, because as we move forward, I think that's key. And I think each supervisor, certainly I in watching my four colleagues, I know each of us cares very much about the county as a whole. And so I think as we get to the details of where boundary lines are drawn here, I don't see that there's a significant change. Templeton is kept whole within its urban reserve line and its CSD. Comments on the school districts have been made. So I'm happy. I don't know if you have other lights on.
I have one more light, and then I will look towards a motion.
I'll look forward to seeing where we go.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to disagree slightly with my colleagues in terms of the ripple effect aspect of this. We're looking at the potential for three supervisors to represent the area of Templeton. Granted, it's not large in numbers in terms of some of the representation, but I think part of our job, and I know what I did, I went back to the folks that I represent and asked them what they felt about all of this and got a considerable amount of input from them. And I tried to come up with something that would somewhat satisfy those. You're correct in part of your assumption that not everybody's going to be happy with all of this. I understand that. But I think to minimize that ripple effect and also to remember the fact that Templeton is not an incorporated community. Some of the other areas that we're talking about, they are incorporated. They do have government that represents them. We, as a supervisor, represent these unincorporated areas. I think that by having three supervisors represent the Templeton area, It has that ripple effect that I think we're trying to ignore. Geographically as well, B1 that I've submitted is a slight tweak. It's not much, and I don't think that percentage of increase that I would see staying within the 5th and the 1st district is that significant. I think that community interest, geographical areas, the way these lines are drawn, in my opinion, they take precedence over the population variance, and I don't think that there's that great of a variance in that. In my my request is consider B1, and it would satisfy a good portion of the folks in Templeton. It's not going to satisfy everyone, but so I'm going to ask that we strongly consider B1 as the primary consideration.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Teixeira, followed by Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. In regards to my colleague's comments, I think the school district brings a very valid point, like Mr. Grant stated, that some of us are in split districts, as we are in the South County. The ripple effect, I look at it, being in the South County and not really being involved in that part except as a whole county, in the way that we deal with Santa Barbara County to the south of us is I've got constituents that have property in southern San Luis County and Santa Barbara County and having to go to two supervisors to talk about this, and it's very confusing in that aspect, and it would be the same thing for the citizens of Templeton to be dealing with three supervisors. In an unincorporated area, I think we need to make it as plain and simple as we can. And I looked at B and C when we voted on them back in July, and I thought B was the superior one. And having it modified to B1 and talking to people from the Templeton area that have made appointments and come to see me in the emails that I've got, that's the one that I'm looking at. I think it's a better way to go. I support B, but I think B1 is a better way to go. And that's the one that I'll be supporting.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, again, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment specifically about B1, and while it does put the population threshold over the 3% target that we were aiming for, originally we were hoping for 2%, but the disproportionate growth over the past 10 years makes this probably the most challenging redistricting effort that we've had in many years. And my concern about grabbing that section west of Templeton, that rural area, is that it really continues to expand the geographical and representational area of District 5, which is already the largest geographical district within the county. And I look at it from the perspective of being able to effectively represent everybody and cover that area effectively. I think that, again, when people have issues in their respective communities, they talk to all of us. While we individually are elected in our respective supervisorial districts, we represent everybody in the county of San Luis Obispo. I think we all hold to that, and I am still in support of option B. I think it is the best proposal.
Mr. Meacham.
Okay, just once again, this 2%, 3%, 3.6% is not significant in numbers. And if you look at the numbers currently, I'm representing 5,000 more than anybody else. And I don't think anybody's ox has been gored basically upon that distribution. I'm going to make a motion that we approve option B1.
Second. Okay. Moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Teixeira on B1. Further comment? I won't be supporting it.
Nor will I, Mr. Chairman. And really, it was based on what Mr. Patterson just said, where you look at the changes to D5, and geographically speaking, District 5 has taken on a huge new physical. I mean, the amount of population is one thing, but the amount of territory is another, and to change from B to B1 adds yet more to an already huge district that's growing. So I'll support Supervisor Patterson on his feelings on that.
Okay. Madam Clerk, roll call on Mr. Meacham's motion on B1, please.
Discussion.
Discussion. One second.
I'm just curious. I need to know why there's so much emphasis on bringing the second district over. Why do we need to do that? All I'm doing is tweaking the second district out and bringing fifth district and first district to be able to represent. So what's the necessity to do that?
The necessity is the guidelines established in redistricting, and I'm sure that whether it's Ms. Neal or Mr. Grant that wants to go over them, but this is a staff developed scenario. And I got to be honest with you, in terms of freeing things as much as we possibly can from politics, I think a staff developed scenario is less. Perception-wise, is less free of politics than one that is developed by a supervisor. That's developed That didn't come to us, from the supervisor working with a population to perhaps address some of their political concerns or their demographic concerns. It was, as all the other scenarios were, a way to balance out the population variance, which is what we've seen is, regardless of what people might want to think, unfortunately, it is the guideline's most important factor, which is population balance in the five.
Well, I disagree with that from the standpoint that it's the community that's given the input of what they want. Mm-hmm. Staff can put this together, but we're asking for community input. Mm-hmm. We've gone out and done that, and that's why that option that I presented was presented, basically because I got feedback from the community. They, in turn, talked on C1 to staff to see if they could modify that as well. But I don't believe the political aspect of this has anything to do with the B1 option, because it's just a slight distribution. I think that there is a political emphasis if you bring District 2 over.
How so?
Why? Give me a reason why District 2 would be in there.
Let me take a crack at this. District 2 was the district that grew the least. And so geographically, as we redistricting, District 2 has to expand to take in more population. And the question is where? I would again go back to looking at the details of the map. I drive east of Cayucas fairly frequently. We don't know where the District 1 and District 2 boundary is over there right now, and we've had a number of constituents who have called one or both supervisors at this point. I don't see that where this line gets drawn on the map is a significant change. Now, some want to make it a significant change, but I haven't heard from anybody in that affected area who thinks that it's particularly one way or another. I go back to the idea. I don't see this is a logical way of expanding the geography of District 2 to add some population that needs to be added. I look at the details of the map. It is, as I said before, low density folks with houses in the hills that have absolutely similar concerns as my neighbors who live in similar geography have. I don't see this as splitting the community of Templeton. I don't know where each and every comment from those who identify as spokesmen for the community of Templeton comes from, but I don't. I just don't see this as a major deal. I think that balance is important. I think that there is benefit to having more supervisors interested in more communities. So I go with our chairman's comments on the concept of unity here, and I'm will not support the motion on the floor.
Call for the vote then, because I can see where this is going.
Okay, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
No.
Mr. Patterson?
No.
And Mr. Hill?
No.
Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and move that we adopt option B to have staff prepare an ordinance for introduction at our next meeting and final hearing on September 6th as per their recommendation.
Okay. I'll second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, second by Supervisor Patterson. Discussion point, Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond to Supervisor Meacham's comment about B1 and just to say that there is an ongoing debate in Templeton as to the support of C or B, and they both are relative to representation of the community and how the community is defined, and should there be one uniform comment coming out of Templeton that they support one or the other, that would carry more weight with me, and they simply don't. And we have made a conscientious effort to keep Templeton whole as it exists. Some of the rural areas, absolutely, they're going to move into different areas, but they'll still enjoy the representation of the board, and so I think B is the overall best choice, and we'll support that.
I want to respond to that.
Mr. Meacham?
Because you just said that you didn't hear from the Templeton folks about a clear voice. There was a clear voice today on either B1 or C1. Mm-hmm. there wasn't on option B. So I think we heard that there was a request to change that, but you're not accepting that.
Actually, I've heard much more from people. We only had, I believe, about six speakers from Templeton here today, which I'm not sure is a representative of very much at all for a community of over 10,000. But I have heard much more from the folks who were pushing on option C, which we agreed in the last one had ripple effects that were problematic, much more than B1 that you have proposed. I only heard one person, in fact, and met with that same person last week. So call for the question, Madam Clerk.
Will that motion include the authorization of the alternative publication?
Indeed.
Okay. So, Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
No.
Mr. Teixeira?
No.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. I see Mr. Alsop.
Maybe we should, can we take a quick
okay. break? Okay, let's take a 15-minute break to give staff time to get in. Clerk?
You're live.
Okay. Welcome back, and if you would please introduce the next item, Madam Clerk.
Item D1, consideration of the revised San Luis Obispo County Local Hazard Mitigation Plan.
That was wonderfully delivered. So we see Mr. Alsop at our lectern, so let's turn it over to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Ron Alsop, Office of Emergency Services. And I'm going to go through a real brief background, and then we'll get into the plan, and actually I'll be brief overall. It's a pretty straightforward document.
Great.
So we're updating our San Luis Obispo County Local Hazard Mitigation Plan, which we're required to have by federal regulations. Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000 required local governments to have hazard mitigation plans if they wanted to remain eligible for certain federal grants, mitigation grants. And those grants included pre-disaster mitigation grants for things such as flood control and wildland fire prevention. Hazard mitigation grant program is one tied into disasters, which we will be getting because of the federal disaster declaration we got for the storms, December-January storms earlier this year, and flood mitigation grants. So even to be eligible to apply for these, we have to have a FEMA-approved local hazard mitigation plan. And this plan is really a compilation of existing documents and procedures that the county already does, such as through the general plan, wildland fire prevention, and some other tasks, you know, our flood mitigation program, or in some cases, recommendations for future efforts. For example, a recommendation is to consider have a vector control district, which we have in the past. And again, these are goals and recommendations. Nothing is new policy. Obviously, as you can surmise with the local hazard mitigation plan, it goes through a risk assessment, you know, what the hazards are. And included in this document, I want to note that this is a natural hazards mitigation plan. So, of course, earthquake, flood, landslides, slash rock slides, a tsunami and seiche, wildfire, extreme weather, coastal storms, biological agents, naturally occurring biological agents, and agriculture pests and diseases. As I noted, this basically is a compilation of existing plans. Examples include our land use planning and building codes, you know, such as the general plan, of course, and including the general plan safety element. In fact, a lot of the information in our mitigation plan is similar to the safety element of the general plan. Fire prevention efforts, including our very good County Fire Safe Council, Flood Control and Water Conservation District. So really what this is a compilation of all these, and you can find all this information in one spot is what this document is. It also implements and suggests prevention efforts to help help us folks be safe, such as our participation in the Great California Shakeout Campaign, which we had a large participation last October, which is when that annual campaign takes place, and we continue to plan on having a large involvement in coming this October, but more of that to follow. But in essence, I want to emphasize in here that what this is, we're putting stuff, this plan shows what the county's doing through all its other programs to mitigate the hazards and help people be prepared. As you can see, they monitor the progress of PG&E as they perform the earthquake studies to see if that has an impact on us in the future. Continue agriculture department pest detection, exclusion, eradication efforts. As we all know, our great agriculture department does a good job with that now. Again, just general examples of stuff they were already doing. And the bottom one is the public health preparedness for prevention, you know, how to properly cough and all that basic information. We originally adopted the plan in 2005, and FEMA approved it in July 2006. So we have a slight window where we're out of FEMA compliance. However, we've requested our plan to be expedited. We need it to be approved by December 3rd in order to be continue to be eligible for grants. This plan was done using a local consulting firm, a firm with whose staff is very familiar with our county, including the various county departments. They've been around a long time, so they did a really good job for us. Also involved in the updating, as they were originally, are staff from planning and building, including the mapping section, county fire, public works, public health, agriculture, waste and measures, and we in the county office of emergency services. As far as what's changed from the 2005 local hazard mitigation plan, really it's we ended the 2005 plan with basically what our results were. An analogy I use is on that bottom bullet there, somewhat like the county's performance-based budgeting, where each county department has goals and performance measures. For example, in our case with the County Office of Emergency Services, how much training we do, how well we do that training, and at the end of the year, we measure that. So what we did is measured our results from 2005. Did we accomplish what we set out to accomplish? And for the most part, we did. And then, of course, for this version, it sets new goals, which actually have been reformatted in an easier-to-follow format. Included in the new goals are two changes I want to make that are somewhat of significance. And one, before I get on here so I don't forget it, is we've added in climate change. There's reference to that. And again, with other issues and plans and procedures that the county's working on, you know, I mentioned the general plan and fire prevention. As you all know, the county is also involved with the climate change committees and processes. So it's nothing that's new policy. It's just a reference to what we're doing. Also, a change in here is an addition to an earthquake scenario. There's a program, a software program called HAZUS, the U.S. Geological Survey, that basically what it does is simulates what would happen in the case, you see the first bullet there, what would happen in San Luis Obispo County if there was a magnitude 7.9 earthquake on the San Andreas with the epicenter at Fort Tejon. And it goes into projections even of how many fatalities there would be, how much property damage there would be, and so on. So the 2005 plan had the San Andreas scenario as well as this, the scenario for magnitude 8 on the Los Osos Fault with the epicenter 5 miles west of US 101. And for this update, we added a hazardous analysis for magnitude 7.2 on the Hosky Fault. That was actually run by a contractor. PG&E actually paid for it as part of their ongoing earthquake studies. However, they did use the U.S. Geological Survey HAZUS model. So, again, this is an action plan for San Luis Obispo County, and our implementation strategy is pretty straightforward. We're going to keep an eye on this and implement our goals and objectives as funding becomes available and or continue our existing programs. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ron. Let me see if we have questions here from the board. Are there questions, Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's another topic that I wonder if Ron might touch on briefly. This is actually an interim step of sorts, and as he was moving with his typical efficiency and speed, I may have missed his reference to the importance of this plan in getting resources available to react to hazards as well. I mean, we have to show the federal and state governments that we're ready to mitigate hazards, but it also has an important effect on our ability to receive compensation if a disaster does strike. And another step forward is to further integrate this into our general plan. And just for the board's reference, we have the Second District Planning Commissioner, Mr. Ken Topping, sitting at the back of the room there, who's deeply involved on a statewide basis with hazard mitigation and planning. And so this is really, this isn't over when we take action today. And I wonder if Ron can speak just briefly as to the financial importance of this to the county.
Certainly. This is somewhat, for lack of a better term, an interim plan, and that since we adopted our original plan in 2005 and FEMA approved 2006, there was legislation, AB 2140, it's commonly referred to, that was introduced in 97, passed in, or in 2007, passed in 2008. It requires local agencies to have their local hazard mitigation plan and general plan safety element tied together, even simply by reference. And then the bite for that is, or the carrot, whichever way you want to go for it, is for disaster recovery funding from the state of California. What existing law states is if we get a state of emergency declaration, like we did, for example, for the tsunami. We received a state of emergency declaration, but not a federal declaration. We get reimbursed 75% of our costs. Or if we do get a federal declaration, then the state pays 75%, and the state will pay us the 75% of the remaining amount. So if we don't have our local hazard mitigation plan and a safety element tied together, and I'll slow down on this because it gets a little convoluted, we're not eligible for 100% reimbursement from the state. So what happens, again, with the existing state law today, if there's a disaster, like with the tsunami, we're getting 75% of our costs reimbursed. With the March storms, the state of California is paying us 75% of what the federal government is not. In many disasters in the past, legislative or state legislative representatives from local areas have introduced legislation to say, hey, you know, we want to bump that up and cover the state will cover 100% of what the local agency is out instead of 75%. Now, the most recent storms, they haven't done that. They did not do that with the storms. And with the tsunami, or actually, I'm sorry, with the March storms, there was a state of emergency declaration. And the state said, we don't have any money. We're not going to give you anything. So right now, we're not missing out on anything. But hypothetically, if we have $100 million of damage from, say, a large earthquake, the county of San Luis Obispo is an entity, lots of structural damage, then conceivably, we could be out $6 million. And that's based on the fact that presuming that large of a disaster, we get a federal disaster declaration, feds would reimburse us 75%, state would reimburse us 75% of the remaining amount, and that totals about 94%. So the carrot or the stick, whichever way you want to look at it from the state, is if you want that little extra bit of money, then you better tie your local hazard mitigation plan into the safety element. As I noted during the presentation, and we're slightly off kilter in our compliance because our plan expired, for lack of a better term, the FEMA-approved plan in July. So we want to get this one approved as soon as possible. What we've already done, just last week, I filed on behalf of the county a notice of interest for a federal grant to basically start this process over again to include the general plan, the safety element.
Thank you, Ron. Mr. Chairman, I just want to bring that forward as a real means of the importance of what we're acting on today. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. And if I could follow along, Ron, I just want to again point out the collaborative nature of the process used to develop this plan and the diversity of entities involved. And besides our county departments, you mentioned agriculture planning, our GIS department within planning, public works, flood control, a lot of people engaged in this process. You mentioned CAL FIRE and also the San Luis Obispo County Community Fire Safe Council, and retired City Fire Chief Bob Newman is here, and he serves on the Fire Safe Council and its executive committee. And we have successfully distributed about $400,000 in the last 2 years for fuel reduction programs as well as education to help prevent the catastrophic effect of wildfire in our county, and appreciate the fact that that is one of the areas where you are putting emphasis, because we all know here in the county that we are prone to wildfire, and we've experienced a number of them over the years, and so it's good that we're planning for those and doing what we can to mitigate the risk.
Great. And on that note, as some of you are aware, we have former County CAL FIRE Chief Dan Turner as a temp help working in our office, actually doing some wildland fire prevention projects. And he had some additional input that didn't make this addition on wildfire mitigation that we will certainly put in the next revision.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to open up to the public, Ron.
Certainly.
If you wouldn't mind, we might have some further comments. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and this is certainly quite a revealing compendium of everything that could go wrong if you stop and think about it. I guess we need to be aware of those things. What it is not and doesn't try to be and doesn't pretend to be is a hazard response plan.
Excuse me.
And, of course, a lot of our policy questions come with how we will respond if and when. And I like the fact that here and there through the plan, it points to the relevant response plans for the different areas. It might be enhanced by some kind of a chart right up front that would say, this is not a response plan, and here are the relevant response plans listed from here, go to here, et cetera, just so that that's clear to the public that uses it. I do have a question. On page 92, there's a kind of a tantalizing reference to the year 1877 without any further narrative, a 3.6-meter tsunami in Cayucas. And, of course, it got me thinking, okay, just Cayucas? Where did it come from? There must be a bigger story here. And so at some point, perhaps, depending on what information is available in terms of primary sources from the times, what did it do? What did it do in other parts of this county's coastline? What did that particular event tell us in terms of how to prepare now for something else that could happen? One other issue that's raised that I think may be a matter for our legislative platform, and that is the question, should Alquist Priolo be amended to deal not only with proximity to active faults, but with the substrate you're on? Often, what you're on, like soft saturated alluvium, can have a much more devastating effect than how close you are to a fault or to an epicenter. And we should be doing everything we can to construct not construct on the most hazardous areas. You know, you have a bowl shaking like this and the jello in it is shaking like this. We simply shouldn't be building in the jello. And since that jello is often something like a wetland that shouldn't be filled anyway, then it can help us meet the goals of our conservation plan as well as protect public safety if we start to be aware of this and map not only the zones in proximity to potentially active faults, but the zones that simply shouldn't be built on anywhere near any fault, which means anywhere in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. And that's all I have from the public, so I will close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Ron, did you have anything further that you needed to add or wanted to add?
No, although Eric brings up a good point on the historical chart. I think for the revision we'll do a little bit more detail, and also for those of us who are challenged on how high a meter is, I think we'll also reference feet as well to make so that everybody's aware of how high a wave was.
Okay, that would be great. Mr. Meacham?
I think that 1877 event was triggered by the Cascadia Fault up out of Washington, Oregon, and that was generated the tsunami effect down our coastline, if I remember reading history correctly. The second part of this is I think oftentimes we place such a strong emphasis on the magnitude of the earthquake, for example, a 6.5, 5, whatever the case may be. It's the duration and how much shaking that you get that in that duration that causes all the damage. Cool. And with now all the talk about climate change and seawater rise and everything else, why are we building a Los Osos sewer project? It's going to be underwater.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
I was just going to say, I'm glad Mr. Meacham clarified that he read about the Cayucas tsunami as opposed to seeing it. But the question that I had that fits in, Mr. Meacham's absolutely right on the effects of earthquakes are much more than magnitude, as Mr. Greening pointed out as well. And as you respond to his comments there, I wonder if any Cal EMA or anybody is developing ground motion maps, you know, that being the ground response to earthquakes of various sorts. Are those being developed, widely developed, or not at all?
As far as ground motion maps, not that I'm aware of. The only ground motion measurements I'm even familiar with are what Diablo Canyon does for the plant. As we all well know, they indeed do not use magnitude. They use ground motion. So no, not that I'm aware. If I could further on, to readdress Eric's question again, is just Cayucas is on that same page that he referenced. There's a reference to a tsunami at Pismo Beach in 1927, And I would like to point out that when we get tsunami warnings, you know, we've had a couple of tsunami warnings, I think three in the past few years, and of course the last one was somewhat of significance. We actually get a targeted area that they expect a high impact area. For example, the last two have been up, no surprise, up along in Northern California, you know, Humboldt County area, and then specifically Port San Luis and San Luis Obispo County. So there, you can't have one tsunami that affects only a certain portion of the coastline, and it's the way our coastline's laid out. You know, I'm certainly no geologist or scientist and don't understand that. But case in point, on March 11th, the only area that received any damage of significance at all was Morro Bay Harbor itself. So they can be isolated areas. The 1927 reference was to an old, I think it was called Oil Port, down in, I think, where Shell Beach is now. That was the only effect that we know of along the coastline. So it can be relatively geographically isolated, presuming it's not a huge tsunami that takes out the whole coastline.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
I don't want to comment further. I was watching the History Channel over the weekend. There was a presentation on the aging infrastructure of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they went through all the different scenarios of flooding, fires, earthquakes, tsunamis, you name it. And obviously there is a trickle down from any one of those in any place else in California that we may experience some type of a disaster. If the levees were to breach, for example, and the water supply was cut off to Southern California. So the scenarios go on, and we could use hypotheticals all day long, but I do greatly appreciate the efforts that are being put forth here. And if I could just one more time, just tell people about the preparedness issue. If you want to do something for your family, give them a Christmas present or birthday present, give them a survival pack. Have them put it in their car, and you'll be thankful for it later.
Good advice. Okay, thank you. I will, if there's no further questions or comments, how about a motion?
I'll move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, second by Supervisor Meacham to approve and authorize the updated and revised local hazard mitigation plan. Thank you very much, Ron, and everyone else involved. Roll call, Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, we are moving toward our closed session. I have no request to speak on closed session, and I see no one coming forward, so I will close it to the public and ask our county council for a time estimate.
About 20 minutes.
Okay, we will go into closed session pronto, and then we will be back at 1:30.
You're live.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our afternoon session of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. Before we get into our presentations, let's go to our county council for any report out of closed session.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. We have actually, even though there's only one scheduled, we have a brief presentation before we get to a larger presentation with the Sheriff's Department and in honor of Christopher Meadows. But Mr. Patterson has a flash mob here. So why don't we give it to you and tell us?
Yes, and I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this opportunity. We have among us today a number of students from Austria, and I'd like to call Gail Gresham to the podium. She's with Education First, which is a program that brings youth from other countries from throughout the world to San Luis Obispo, and she'll tell you a little bit about what they're doing.
Gail. And I must also add, we have one girl from Slovakia and one from West Germany in this group. We have 29 wonderful high school students here who've been staying throughout North County in a homestay program. However, during the summer, we've had close to 400 students staying in homes throughout this county. And one of my students would like to tell you what it's been like for her for a second, okay? And I also want to share with you, we've used public transportation to get here today. We did the RTD, and it worked very well. So we want to thank the RTD for helping us, too. Anyway, Lisa.
They gave him a half-price discount.
Yeah. Welcome. Can you state your name for the record, please?
M, like that?
Yes.
Okay. I'm a little bit nervous. Okay. Yeah, we all have a wonderful time here, and the people are so nice, and we have amazing host families. And I would have never imagined that everything is like that good. And it's just amazing being here, and all the people are so friendly, and it's really nice to be here. And we have a wonderful time. I think everybody, I speak for my whole group, and everybody has a great time, and we're all so happy to be here.
And where are you from?
Austria, Vienna.
Okay, and your name?
Lisa.
And last name, if we could, for the record, Lisa?
Yaldis.
Okay, they'll never get that. Well, we're happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being here, and I'm wondering if all the members of the group would stand up so we can recognize you all.
Okay.
Thank you for visiting San Luis Obispo County, and we too think it is one of the most exquisite places on the planet, so we welcome you here.
Yeah, always. Okay, we are, I know that you're going to be going on for some other things, I think, but we have a presentation that my colleague will give, and we also, as you see, we have some of our members of the Sheriff's Search and Rescue Team, which we're very pleased to have with us as they do great work for our community.
And to approve the resolution.
Second. Oh, that's okay. We have a motion to approve the resolution and a second by Supervisor Gibson. Roll call, please, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. And
thank you.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. It's my honor and my privilege to read this proclamation. I'd invite the Meadows family, if they would come up to the dais or the podium, please. And Sheriff Parkinson, if you want to accompany them. The following is recognizing the christening and the naming of the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office Patrol Rescue Boat 0188 as the Christopher C. Meadows. The following resolution is hereby offered in red. And I'd also like to mention that Christopher also worked for San Luis Ambulance. And Mr. Kelton is here, I believe, with San Luis Ambulance. Nice to have you here. Whereas Christopher Meadows began his service with the Sheriff's Search and Rescue Unit in February of 2008, Christopher's energy, personality, and strong desire to help others drove him to strive for a high level of success in all his endeavors. And whereas Christopher was working with the Search and Rescue Unit at the Oceano Dunes on May 24, 2009, he was responding to a call for service when he was involved in an all-terrain vehicle accident and made the ultimate sacrifice. Those who dedicate their lives to helping others do so knowing that there is a risk, and there is a long-standing tradition in the law enforcement marine community of naming the patrol rescue vessels after dedicated employees who have made that ultimate sacrifice. Dedicating a vessel in Christopher's memory will allow this commitment and energy to continue to be honored and to abide by the motto that others may live. And whereas on August 16, 2011, the Sheriff's Office christens Patrol Rescue Boat 0188 as the Christopher C. Meadows, continuing the tradition of the highest level of service and carrying the torch in Christopher's memory. Therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby join with the Sheriff's Office by recognizing that on August 16, 2011, Patrol Boat Rescue Boat 0188 has been christened the Christopher C. Meadows in memory of a young man of courage who was loved by his friends and family.
Just want to get a picture real quick before, and we'll let you speak.
Ian.
Sheriff, do you want to come in and get a picture with the Meadows?
Thank you.
Why is it the littlest girl has the biggest camera?
And no tripod.
Sheriff?
You know, before Mr. Meadows speaks, I just want to thank the Meadows family for coming down and letting us honor Christopher this way. I also like to recognize the members of Search and Rescue that actually worked with Chris, and thank you for coming, and obviously the employees from the Sheriff's Office. San Luis Ambulance, thank you for coming and honoring Chris. And then finally, the two deputies up front, they're the ones who came up with this idea, and so I want to recognize their idea for presenting this and christening of this boat. So thank you.
Welcome. It's great to be here. And on behalf of our family, I'd just like to thank the Board of Supervisors and Sheriff Parkinson and certainly Todd, Steve, and Captain Jack for for getting this rolling. When I got the call from Todd about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were both shocked and honored and surprised by this. So we're really happy that it came to fruition. When Todd called and asked if it was okay, I kind of chuckled to myself a little bit, because little did anybody know at the time outside of our family, but Chris was an avid boater. And from an early age, he would accompany his grandparents on their 36-foot twin-drive trawler. And as early as age 8, he was starting the engines and casting off the lines. And by age 12, his grandfather actually let him dock the boat, which, if you knew how my father-in-law, how nervous he was around anything, to the fact that he let Chris dock that boat at such a young age is a testament to Chris's abilities as a young skipper. So this is particularly heartwarming for our family. And our biggest fear as a family is that Chris will be forgotten. And so when we have permanent memorials to him, like the naming of this vessel, it really helps keep his memory alive. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Meadows. And I know we have a presentation here from one of our deputies.
I'd like to present to the Meadows family. It's a photograph of the now newly named Christopher C. Meadows as of August 16, 2011, and it's a picture of the patrol rescue boat that will be working Lake Nacimiento and all the other waterways in San Luis Obispo County. So I'd like to present this to the Meadows family.
Great.
That's great. Looks much smaller in the picture than it really is.
That's why we brought it down here.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Meadows, we're very pleased that you could make time, and your wife and daughter as well. And as you said, I think it's certainly a testament to the Sheriff's Department that they will not forget the sacrifice that Christopher made to protect people and to save people. So we're going to take a brief break so that we could go outside where I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the boat is actually hopefully. Oh, okay, unless somebody has borrowed it, in which case it's creating new memories. We will go outside to commemorate that, and then we'll be back in a few minutes. Okay, we're back from our brief break to honor Christopher Meadows and the newly christened Sheriff's Rescue Boat. We're back from that presentation, and we're very glad to be able to honor the memory of Christopher Meadows, and we are back to our business now. And Madam Clerk, if you would introduce the first hearing item, please, of the afternoon.
C2, a hearing to consider a request by Sunny Acres Incorporated of options for a waiver or deferral of building permit fees and public facilities fees for a new single-family dwelling of approximately 8,000 square feet, 2nd District.
Okay. Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Good afternoon, Cami Griffin, County Planning. We are here before you today to present you some options relative to waiving or deferring fees. There are two sets of fees here, the building permit fees as well as the public facility fees. And with that, I'll turn it over to John Bissell, who will be making the presentation.
Mr. Bissell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, John Bissell, County Planning staff. I wanted to first orient people. There's been a lot of talk about different buildings in the news and things like that. And just to orient you where the main ranch house is, the stucco barn, the dairy barn, and what is now be the second house, which would eventually become a farm support quarters if everything was completed as far as this project goes. So the history, Sunny Acres Incorporated in 2002. It operates as a nonprofit organization focused on providing a sober living environment for people with drug and alcohol addictions. There were some prior fee waiver requests to the Board of Supervisors. There were 2008 conditional use permit request. That was granted, although that hasn't progressed because we're still waiting for information from the applicant to process that. Your board also considered a building permit and a public facility fee waiver for an addition to the main house and a farm support unit at that time, and that was denied. I might go over that a little bit as why what the difference is between then and now. In 2008, you know, we like to put things in boxes as planners, and Dan Duvall's Sunny Acres project fit into the residential care part of the ordinance. And so residential care for seven or more persons required a conditional use permit. In 2010, the ordinance was changed pursuant to a state law regarding supportive housing. And supportive housing is a little different from residential care. And what Mr. Duvall's project is falls more under supportive housing than residential care. In this sense, for a property that, as long as they're within their required density, they can have a supportive housing residence on the property with no defined number of people. So there's not a threshold of seven or more now for a discretionary permit for a supportive housing facility. Code enforcement issues. The property has been subject to recent code enforcement action by the county and county staff, and there is currently pending litigation to resolve the unresolved violations. So residential density, the property is allowed two primary residents and a farm support based on the amount of agriculture and or nursery uses. We determined that one farm support unit can be allowed based on what Mr. Duvall has on the property right now. So the project is to construct the new 8,000 square foot house, which would be a second primary for Sunny Acres clients. Convert the existing residence on the east side of the property to a farm support unit through an agreement that we have a standard agreement for that that we use on these farm support units. So the project before you basically is the request for the fee waiver of the for the building permit fees and public facility fees based on providing a public benefit to the county. The building permit and farm support portions are actually ministerial, and your board won't be acting on those. Just the fee waiver. So fee waiver or deferral, building permit fees, the public benefit is the one of the ways to waive building permit fees. And on Exhibit B, on in your staff report on page 8, are the requirements for waiving building permit fees, showing an obvious public benefit. Public facility fees are a little different. That is... has to be no reasonable nexus between the impacts of development and the fee charged, and that's in Exhibit A. The area in bold talks about the basis for an appeal of public facility fees. So building permit fees, public benefit. As noted on their website, Sunny Acres is a nonprofit organization focused on providing clean and sober living environment for people with alcohol, with drug and alcohol addictions. Now, Sunny Acres also targets people that... are primarily homeless, very very low income. Your board could make the determination that is a public benefit. They're not served very well in other places or other organizations in the county, so that's one option there. Public facility fees, the waiver, finding for a waiver is difficult on those. The board has deferred these fees in the past. One was the SunCare project, which was a program for at-risk youth. Your board could determine that Sunnyker's clients do not impact county facilities to the extent of the fee charged, or that the use does not generate the same need for public facilities as other residential units. That would be one way your board could look at this project or this request. Additional note, in addition to whatever action your board takes today, the property is still subject to the code enforcement action and pending litigation, and that must be resolved before the building permit can be issued. So recommendation is to consider the request by Sunny Acres and provide direction to staff. Some of the options we talked about or mentioned in the report would be to deny the request altogether, waive building permit and public facility fees, waive building permit fees and defer the facility fees or defer both fees. So there is, we could make findings, you know, to do any of those. I think that your board would so choose. So I would conclude my presentation with that.
Okay, thank you, John. Questions? Cam, is that your light on?
Yeah, actually, yeah. I just wanted to add a couple of things. The first is that today any action that you take would be a tentative action. We would need to come back with findings and a resolution based on the direction that you provide us. And I did want to clarify that if there are meeting rooms or dining halls or offices that are separate from a single-family residence, those kinds of uses associated with a facility would still be considered residential care facility. The reason that we're saying that this single-family residence falls into supportive housing, that definition is that it is just a single-family residence. It could be purchased by you or me after and used as a single-family residence. So it would fall into that other category.
Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pretty clear on the, because we have a precedent on the deferral of public facility fees, we condition that on the specific use that SunCare, the specific program that SunCare was providing. Am I given to understand that we could issue a what amounts to a conditional fee waiver on the building permit fees by requiring a certain use, or is this a yes or no decision we make today?
I'll have council jump in and help me out. Conditional in the sense that you could issue the building permit based on, for instance, one of the items in the staff report on your page C25 that suggests that the applicant could enter into an agreement with the county to restrict the rent that was charged for that. As to its use, as far as we're concerned, would be a single-family residence. Supportive housing is allowed in single-family residences.
Okay, but we could require some sort of agreement that establishes the public benefit, which is the basis on which we would choose to waive the building permit fee.
That's correct.
Just to be clear. Okay. And
you want to get clarification. Mr. Grante, did you want to weigh in or Mr. Jensen?
Yes, I think you could, as they suggested, defer the fees. That would amount to a conditional situation. Defer them, but impose them if certain conditions are violated.
Okay. And the other issue is that in terms of, the cash flow of this, there is no fee required of Sunny Acres at this point until such time as a permit could be issued. Is that correct?
That's correct. The permit actually is in being processed. It's going through plan check. The initial deposit was paid by the applicant, and so additional fees aren't needed until time of issuance.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other board questions at this time? Mr. Patterson, I see you.
Yes, just for clarification, Mr. Chair, Ms. Griffin or Mr. Bissell, speaking of fees, there would be none required until issuance over and above what's already been paid, but there would be no issuance of permits until all existing code violations are cleared. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. We don't have any more board questions this time, so I'll open it to the public. Mr. Belcher, I don't know if you or your client, Mr. Duvall, would like to speak, but if so, could you make sure to turn in a slip before you go, but we'll let you sleep now. Speak now, please.
Okay. Yes, I will speak for Mr. Duvall, John Belsher, and I will fill out a speaker slip in a moment.
Thank you.
Appreciate the effort the staff's gone to give you some options. As you know, this nonprofit runs with volunteer staff and Mr. Duvall's help. It doesn't have funds other than what the meager earnings of the clientele can provide through whatever programs they may be party to. So we are fine with the idea that the waiver, the fee would be somehow conditioned or waived or deferred for so long as the program operates on the property. And I think that's what you've done in the past, and it seems appropriate for this situation. What's a little different here is the staff is proposing that you become more specific about the way the program is defined and actually avoid that altogether and somehow make it an affordable housing requirement for a single-family house. And to do that, they said, well, if you're going to do that, then you can only charge $1,000 a month for all 14, 15 residents of this house. Well, the program doesn't function if the people don't pay enough money for the accommodations and food, you know, something like $300 a month or more per resident. So I think the difficulty may be that way the low-income housing laws are written, it may not be possible to assign a price per bedroom. So the staff apparently just defaulted to the general rule. Well, single-family house, $1,000 a month, that's the most you can charge. Well, that's essentially a denial of our request. All we really need to do, in my view, is require that the nonprofit continue to run a safe and sober program at the facility for the residents. And for so long as that program operates as a nonprofit and meets the requirements of nonprofit status under federal law, it will have satisfied the requirements, I think, or the goals of this board should it wish to grant this fee waiver. So I would request that you not tie this fee waiver to a requirement that the total rent charged would be tied to some affordable housing 30-year requirement. I think it's more logical that you tie it to the safe and sober program that currently exists and has existed for several years. And if we're going to take some time to make findings, I'm sure the staff could work with you to achieve that. I think the other questions were already addressed by the board in terms of when this would be applied. And I want to thank Cami actually did work with us to give us a reduced filing fee so we could get in and get plan checked. We did pay not a small sum, but we paid a reduced amount to get into plan check. And we are through a couple of different plan checks on this this building permit application. So this is really the solution that the board and the staff wanted us to pursue from day one. So we hope that you'll allow this $20,000 weight that's hanging around our neck to be diffused and by your action today. I think there may be one or two people but that may want to speak in favor of this, but we chose not to bring everyone out here today and to focus on the technical aspects of this request. So with that, I'll be available if you need me. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Belsher? Thank you, Mr. Belsher. Let me go to some of the commenters. Dane Sensor, followed by Gene Naylor.
Dane Sensor, a homeless advocate. I do want to make one slight correction. I did speak at public comment this morning. I meant to say I don't smoke and I don't have a drug problem. And I said, I don't drink. I want to do correct that. I do love a German stout beer every now and then. So with that correction, I'd like to say in regards to this here. I spoke to the first time with Mr. Duvall yesterday on Sunny Acres and about his plan, his vision, his mission, on what he really wants and what he's trying to accomplish. And to me, as a person who is homeless. It sounded logical, realistical, practical, helpful, and most of all, to me, it made common sense. That was the most thing that seemed to strike out, common sense. And as you know, the New Times has started a homeless project, which this week I happen to be the person in the homeless project. Not that it's something I am proud of. However, it's what it is. And I want to quote the New Times here last week. I don't know if you read the thing here, but this was a quote that I thought was so important, what they said here. And it said, "We're not bound by funding limitations or red tape. Our plan won't take 10 years to complete. It won't require executive directors or committees or implement. We don't need thousands of dollars or meetings dedicated to planning the next meeting. We're relying on common sense and the blissfully naive assumption that people will help people. And when your goal is to help anyone you can't fail." I couldn't agree with them more. Sometimes common sense is the most logical and practical way to go. And I would suggest that this Board of Supervisors, which I think they're doing right now, is finding some harmony between Mr. Duvall's project and the Board of Supervisors. I think that's to be commended on both behalves. Find some harmony amongst you. Look what we can do to find the solutions. It's sort of been a bitter battle here, neighbors, people, community. However, I think with all this being said and happened, this can turn into a silver lining, and I really believe that. And I will do as an individual myself whatever I can to help do homeless people, my own personal, experience, what I've experienced, and do what we can do to find the solutions to this serious problem that we have in the county. So I commend the Board of Supervisors, Mr. Duvall, and everybody involved, the New Times, for finding a solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sensor. Ms. Naylor, followed by Christine Mulholland.
Good afternoon, Board of Supervisors. My name is Giselle Naylor. I have property in Cambria and Oceano, and I never thought I'd be speaking on behalf of Dan Duvall. But because I know what it's like to be homeless and low income, and I was homeless for 2.5 years in Seattle, and I got a very good education about the types of programs that are available and the guidelines that the county could follow in providing extremely low-income, affordable housing to the community, at the same time hitting two birds with one stone, taking care of an offender population that is normally hard to place. No matter where they go, communities don't like it. So the issue is keeping a small group in the same place and in an environment where they can actually earn a living and learn a living. Is that a public benefit to the community? And I would say it is, yes. And there are ample regulations, both at the federal level through HUD and through other nonprofit structures. I don't know if Catholic Community Services, for example, has done a lot to improve neighborhoods that have fallen into disrepair in the city areas like San Luis Obispo, and they've tied in low-income funding to help revitalize certain areas that are low-income. On Los Osos Valley Road, you've got what has traditionally been agricultural use, and yet there's been considerable development on Los Osos Valley Road. So for me, the issue is, what are you going to do about people who are extremely low income? They seem to get swept under the rug, and how are you going to handle an offender population? As far as the fees go, the rent that's being called a maximum that could be charged by the county is so low, it would be less than $100 per person if you're talking about a residence that's 14 rooms. You in order to make that even doable, what I would suggest is not completely waive the fees, but to make the fees really have a nexus. I can't see what over $20,000 worth in permit fees, whether it's for public facilities use or building permits, really is a nexus between a beneficial use. It almost obliterates the ability to provide a beneficial use. What I think you should do is cut the fee in half at least, or make it a nominal fee, and then require that the fee be paid out like a certain percentage of the income being brought in to the property, even if it's, you know, 25% of each person's rental.
Thank you, Ms. Naylor.
This has the possibility of being a profit development property as well.
Appreciate that. Ms. Mulholland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon to you and members of the board. My name is Christine Mulholland. I live in the city of San Luis Obispo. For more than a decade and a half, long before he began to allow homeless people to camp, Dan Duvall has refused to acknowledge the right of the county to regulate land use on his property. He has consistently refused to comply with county code enforcement and court orders. Staff time and court expenses have cost taxpayers who foot the bill a bundle. Unauthorized dumping continues with dump trucks of dirt and tanks of gray glop just poured onto the land. So I find it ironic that now he comes asking the county for favors. Many of us support homeless services and would have no problem with a well-regulated shelter and certified sobriety program in the neighborhood. But until a clear record of ongoing compliance with the law has been established, the county should not be granting any favors. Please decline to grant the fee waivers at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mahone. And that's the last request to speak I have on this, so I'm going to close it to the public and bring it back to the board. And I wonder, and maybe Mr. Gibson's going to ask this, but if Ms. Griffin would speak to Mr. Belcher's main objection, which is the connection to the very low-income household part of it.
Thank you, and I'll have John jump in
okay.
Also. Staff chose extremely low income because that is typically what is equivalent to the homeless population, and we understood that that's the population primarily that Mr. Duvall serves. My understanding was that the total rent charged was based on the household size, and so the 14 bedrooms was considered. It wasn't just that it was a single-family residence. And, John, do you have anything further to add to that?
Well, this is sort of a unique case, of course. And the SunCare project, which your board looked at before, you actually deferred facility fees. The building permit fees weren't part of that one, but you did defer the facility fees based on them maintaining that use. As Mr. Belcher discussed, there wasn't a restriction on income or any kind of rent in that project. Because of the separation now between residential care and supportive housing, I think it's probably possible for your board to do the same thing and require that it may be maintained as a supportive housing residence, you know, not a facility necessarily, but a supportive housing residence, and limited to people of a certain income level without placing a income or a rent restrictions per se on it. I think that's a possible way to go.
I wonder if Mr. Belcher could answer questions, and I think we may have some more on this issue. I know I see some lights from my colleagues.
Sure.
Mr. Belcher.
By the way, that's a perfectly appropriate direction to go.
as far as we're concerned.
Okay. And so Mr. Duvall is charges the clients out there $300?
It's a rough fee if they can afford it. Some people pay zero because they just have no means. And it's $300 for meals, programs, everything.
And typically that income comes from what source?
Oh, they might have disability payments or some other government allowance,
right,
if they have any money at all.
So I guess my question is obviously the goal of any sort of program, whether it be homeless without the sobriety program or with it, is self-sufficiency. So my concern is if, in fact, the residents are paying all their money to Mr. Duvall for housing, any other service, then how are they going to have money to eventually become self-sufficient and be able to rent something on their own and et cetera?
Well, two ways. One, the program fees are less. Generally, the disability payments are more than an order of $800 to $1,000 a month. So it's not all the money that they receive. Secondly, they earn money through the nonprofit by working at the various establishments. Maybe they sell garden products, or they can raise money from wood splitting or scrap metal or whatever. So the residents do have some ways to earn money back through the program. And so the combination of those things is to help people to gain job skills, vocational skills, and perhaps save money to get on their feet. So $300 a month is it's just a ballpark. It's less than most of them, less than half, I think, that they earn normally with their disability payments. And it does cover all their room and board, utilities, programs, training, everything. So there are no paid staff. Dan Duvall actually earns nothing off this program. He, in fact, is loaned it tens of thousands of dollars of his own personal sums over the years. And anyway, that's the best way I can answer.
Before I let Mr. Belcher go, are there questions directly for Mr. Belcher?
I have
Belcher
one for him.
No. I don't. Okay, Supervisor Patterson and then Supervisor Gibson for Mr. Belcher.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Belcher, on the Sun Acres website, the program is described as a residential program that incorporates living and working on the property with counseling to help clients overcome their addictions. And I'm curious about the counseling program. Could you describe that? I'm interested in who performs that counseling, if they're certified or licensed to do that, how often those sessions occur, because one of the conditions that we're tying potential fee waivers to is this ongoing counseling and the programs to help benefit these folks with addictions. And so I'm curious to know what those programs are.
Okay. there are three ways I can respond to that. I'm not an expert in addiction and other mental disease questions, but there are mandatory meetings, sometimes more than one a day for all the residents. They're AA-based meetings, 12-step programs. Anyone familiar with the 12-step programs will know that there is no paid, licensed, or anything else associated with 12-step programs. They're self-run. In this case, they're run by volunteer staff for the most part, but also by residents. AA doesn't have a paid professional organization aspect to it. The second thing is that as part of the Sunny Acres program, they drive people to their appointments with mental health organizations and other government run programs, or in some cases private physician treatment. So the program includes that as a service within its fee, program fee. So for the residents that have those outside, and there are many that have outside medical evaluations and prescriptions and professional help and government help outside Sunny Acres.
Okay. Is there any documentation that these programs occur, they're ongoing? I mean, is there some way to verify currently that these programs are indeed ongoing?
I think it'd be we easily could provide you with evidence of those programs in whatever form you need, and we have paper records now of those programs, but
Okay, and then one other issue that concerns me. I was sworn in to the Board of Supervisors or onto the Board of Supervisors in January of 2005, and shortly thereafter we had a Sunny Acres code enforcement issue before us. And Mr. Duvall stood at that very podium and swore that he would take care of those code enforcement violations. He promised that he would do that if we gave him the opportunity, which we chose to do. And here we are 6.5 years later with not only those issues unresolved, but additional code enforcement issues unresolved. And I'm curious to know what assurances do we have that the existing code enforcement issues will indeed be resolved.
Okay. Well, I guess there's two ways to address that. First, shortly after you were sworn in, within, I think, 18 months, there was an all-clear letter written by Art Trinidad saying that all the outstanding violations had been addressed. It was a couple years later than that some new issues came up, and those are the ones that we are now dealing with. So to answer your question about what assurances do you have, well, there's a gentleman in a black robe in Department 9 that has assured the county that he's going to make sure that Mr. Duvall obeys the law. You know, and I'm working with him. I've submitted 3-4 building permit applications in the last couple weeks, all of which were rejected at the county level. The problem here is that the way in which we achieve compliance with the county law, we're still struggling with. But I think within the next, 8 weeks, we're going to gain some real clarity. If I can get some cooperation from county staff on exactly what I can do with the facilities that are there so they won't just shut down, then we might be able to get somewhere. And I'm really hopeful that if we get this building application ready to issue, that the substantial community support that's out there, the volunteer carpenters and the volunteer material providers, can step up. We can build a brand new project that's going to supplant these other facilities that are considered substandard. So, we're all working pretty hard on it right now. We have a judge's hearing in 2 weeks to decide if we're making progress, and the judge is committed to giving close supervision to this code enforcement resolution.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions for Mr. Belcher. However, I have a follow-up with staff.
Okay, we'll get back to that. Mr. Gibson,
For Mr. Belcher, are you familiar with Sunny Acres, the nonprofit's finances?
Somewhat.
It is my understanding is they have not chosen to seek, as most nonprofits do, contributions from the community. And can you speak to whether contributions from the community are a significant part of their cash flow or not, or their revenue source?
There are contributions from the community. The campaign really is aimed to begin when we get the permit for this new facility. We expect there'll be mostly in-kind contributions. But there's no prohibition on accepting contributions from the public. I don't think there's an active outreach campaign other than the campaign that's been ongoing to build support for the building that we're talking about today. And so we have that's mostly an in-kind campaign.
So as you had testified, the rents received are the major source of revenue for operating the programs at Sunny Acres, the nonprofit.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Are you familiar with their tax returns? Are their tax returns current?
I'm not. I'm not handling that part of the corporate structure.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. And Mr. Chairman, Supervisor Patterson hit on a couple of threads here that I think useful for us to pursue documentation and the finances.
We'll come back. Thank you, Mr. Belcher. Mr. Meacham has some questions, and I'll come back to Supervisor Patterson.
I want a question for staff, if I could. As Mr. Sensor mentioned, this has been kind of a contentious history over time. And I'm not interested in waiving these fees. However, I would be interested in deferring the fees with the option to waive these once this came into compliance. Is that an option for us?
You said you can't issue anything until everything comes into compliance.
Right.
If everything comes into compliance at that point in time, and then as these other building permits are, I guess, are requested, I just need to see assurance on the other side that something's going to happen, but with rather than just say to go ahead and waive these fees altogether. If there's a way to defer them until everything comes into compliance and then take a look at it to see if, in fact, we would want to waive them then. I don't know how that...
I guess we could continue this hearing and to a date uncertain, and we could come back to you as Mr. Duvall makes progress on cleaning up the violations, or after Mr. Duvall made progress on cleaning up the violations.
I guess because I'm looking for that good faith step on Mr. Duvall's part. I mean, we've been trying to work with you as much as we can, but if we were to just to go ahead and waive these fees right now and then nothing happens, we're going to be back at this all over again. So I'm just looking for a little direction here.
Some ideas. Mr. Patterson and then Mr. Gibson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up with staff regarding Mr. Belcher's comment that they had submitted three applications for a number of permits, but those were rejected, and I'm wondering if staff could speak to that as to why perhaps they were rejected or why they weren't put into process.
We did take in those three building permits, evaluate whether or not we could continue processing. One of the permits for freestanding restrooms, which we have acknowledged to Mr. Duvall in a letter dated September 2010, are allowable and could be allowed, did not contain enough plans for us to process. The other two, one was to upgrade electrical and plumbing in the what's known typically as the dairy barn, and the other was to permit work done in the stucco barn. Were not able to be processed because those barns need to be brought back to ag buildings or demolished pursuant to the court order. And again, that was set forth in a letter to Mr. Duvall dated September 2010, where we tried to outline exactly what needed to happen for each of the buildings on the site.
So he has been given that information prior to the submission
Yes.
of those permits. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me put a couple suggestions on the table here. The history of this property, I think, demands special attention both in a couple of different ways, both in an effort to help the people who are being helped out there, but also to give the county assurances that we're moving in the right direction on code enforcement. Let me just say to set the stage here that compliance with the code enforcement issues is before this project gets going is a given. That's part of our land use ordinance. And as Ms. Griffin indicated, that before a permit can be issued, these code enforcement issues need to be resolved. And it's actually one step more significant than that is that they are under a specific court order to have these things resolved. So what I'd like to put out is the following framework, and I'd be happy to discuss it with colleagues. We can refine something we can agree on here. I'm okay with the building permit waiver based on a couple of conditions. One of them would be full compliance with the court order, and second would be an agreement to provide suitable documentation that the public benefit is occurring out there. And I think Mr. Belcher's comments, Mr. Bussell's comments about rent restrictions are well taken, given the way that this particular nonprofit has chosen to organize its income stream. But I think we need at least a couple of things. We need the tax returns, yearly. If we were to grant this fee waiver, and I'm also going to talk about public facility fee deferral. We would need the tax returns of Sunny Acres showing that it is, you know, what its financial situation is. It is a public benefit corporation. I don't see that as an invasion of its privacy since they are enjoying tax-exempt status. I think we also need to have some sense of how many clients are being served, what the income levels of those clients are, what the rents received are. And if we go down this road, we could ask County Council to establish the information that's necessary to be yearly assured that that the program is operating in a manner that's beneficial to the clients and thus serving a public benefit. Again, I should have put it out in the front. Fee waiver conditional, building permit fee waiver conditional on compliance with the court order, and the continued deferral of public facilities fees, consistent with what we did in the previous case some years ago, based on yearly documentation that a public benefit program is being conducted out there. So that I think is a reasonable way to go. I think if we see compliance with the court order, which will require ongoing compliance with our code enforcements, I think we will see a significant change in behavior on the part of this property owner and results on this property. And I'd be interested in colleagues' comments on that as a structure.
Mr. Meacham.
Just a clarification. So you're talking about waiving the building permit fees but deferring the public facility fees.
Correct.
Is that what I hear?
Correct.
Okay. I feel like, I support it. I feel like we're participating still in this dumb show of trying to figure out how to get Mr. Duvall to come into compliance, and this is a sort of decades-long saga at this point, it seems. And, unlike what has often been depicted in some parts of the media, if you look at the file that the county has, and I have, and it's rather voluminous, the county has always wanted to and always tried to in a variety of ways to work with Mr. Duvall so that he could operate in a way that is safe and legal and truly to the best benefit and welfare to the folks that would come out to his ranch. That's always been the case, and it's always been a struggle to get Mr. Duvall to essentially honor his commitments. And I hope that this could continue on, I don't know, indefinitely. I think that this board would like to see the issues addressed for him to come into compliance and for us to be able to work with him. But, I'm up for it with the sort of understanding that I won't have high hopes just yet unless there's some sort of hopefully amazing change of heart. I like Dan. I think he is an interesting guy. I just wish he would truly make this happen and bring these things into compliance. And we could all sort of go back to doing what we want to do. So with that, I'll look to my colleagues for some sort of motion.
I don't know. Ms. Patterson, did you have a question or comment?
I certainly concur with Supervisor Hill's comments. This has been somewhat grueling on the part of county staff and this board to get Mr. Duvall to work with us so we can work with him. And I actually spent a morning out there with several other people a couple of years ago to help plant a screen between his facility and the neighbors. And there has been a parade of volunteers in the 6.5 years that I've been involved with Mr. Duvall. I continually hear that even the people that volunteer with Mr. Duvall are not happy with the progress being made out there, that he isn't cooperative, and that's been our experience here. And I'm willing to try again and help where we can. And as Mr. Hill pointed out, at every opportunity we have tried to work with Mr. Duvall. The lack of cooperation has not been on the county's part. It's been on Mr. Duvall's part. And the one other thing that I'd like to put on the table is one of the conditions mentioned in the staff report is that should fees be deferred, both building and or waived, both building and PFF, that if either the programming stops or the facility is no longer used for the services that actually provide the public benefit, that all fees are due and payable, and I'm just curious to know how we can secure that indeed those fees would be paid should either of those conditions cease. And so maybe County
Jensen.
Council could respond.
He's got a few things he'd like to.
Yes, I was a little bit unclear because I was writing and trying to listen to what Supervisor Gibson indicated in his framework. But what I heard was there was a proposed a waiver of building permit fees that would be conditional, right? At least I think that's what
yes.
I heard. And it wasn't clear to me what would happen if the down the line, if the facility were up and running and the suitable documentation weren't provided, would that mean you would seek to impose the fees, or would they have been waived and just requirements imposed without a sanction?
My initial thought was to waive the building permit fees but hold off on the public facilities fees and have them imposed.
Right.
But what I heard Supervisor Patterson say was deferral on both, and I'm willing to entertain that. Deferral on both as long as there's a program, but upon cessation of the program, both be due and payable. I'm happy to entertain that as well.
Yes, and I think we could accomplish that. And conceivably, if Mr. Duvall would be willing to do this, he could give us a deed of trust to secure a performance of that payment obligation that would be part of that framework.
Mr. Meacham?
That's kind of where I was going. I was a little bit concerned about just completely waiving. Once we waive them, they're waived.
Okay.
But on a deferral with conditions on that, and I can support that.
Okay.
We make a motion, Ms. Griffin, did you want to?
I did want to clarify. Okay. Did that also include maintaining the property without violations?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
And let me ask Ms. Griffin. These plans are in plan check right now. My motion will be to continue this. How long would you think a reasonable time if we went date certain?
We could probably bring back findings and a resolution to you if there's time on maybe the 13th of September. I think that's your next.
Okay. I was sort of, I guess my question was more how much longer do you think these plans might be in plan check?
Well, that's hard to say. There's a number of issues that still need to be resolved relative to both the building and the septic system. So it could be a number of months down the road.
Okay. So probably it's better to set a date certain and go ahead on this conditional deferral, and we'll do it. So you're suggesting September 13th, Madam Clerk? Is there time?
35. The next available with time that I'm aware of is September 27th.
And I think that given what you're saying about plan check and given the time frame of the court order and a whole bunch of things, I don't see a – I was thinking 30 to 60 days at
okay.
least. So, yeah. So why don't we say 60 days if we're into later part of October?
Maybe the 18th of October, 25th of October.
10:18. How's that?
Check with
Madam Clerk.
What's that?
50 minutes left.
Okay. Let's. I'm going to move that we continue this matter to October 18th. That we direct staff to return at that point with findings and conditions to implement the deferral of both the building permit fees and the public facility fees for the project that's being considered, presented to us today. That deferral will be conditional on compliance and continued compliance with the court order currently issued and yearly documentation of continuance of a sober living facility program that shows public benefit, leaving the details of that documentation to staff to present to us.
I'll second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Meacham. Madam Clerk, did you get that?
Yes.
Okay. If there's no further comment, roll call, please.
And I had one question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
Tentative motion.
Oh, I had one question.
Yes, Mr. Bissell. Well,
does that include getting the documentation from Sunny Acres regarding the tax returns and clients and all that?
That was what I was going to leave to planning and okay. staff and council to work out exactly what documentation they would want to see to establish the public
okay.
benefit.
Okay.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. If you could, thank you. If you could introduce the next item, Madam Clerk.
Item C3, a continued hearing to consider an appeal by Verizon Wireless of the Planning Commission's denial of a request by Verizon Wireless and Shirley Osabin for a conditional use permit to allow for the construction and operation of an unmanned wireless communications facility at 1735 Las Tablas Road in Templeton, 1st District.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to recuse myself from this discussion. I'll give the reasoning behind it. My wife works for Verizon, although she works nothing connected with the phone system. She works for Verizon Business, but however, I've been advised by counsel that it would be best that I recuse myself.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Singwald, how are you?
Doing well. Good afternoon, Chairman Hill, members of the board, Erlen Singwald, Department of Planning and Building. So this item was continued from July 19th. The purpose of that continuance was to allow Verizon additional time to investigate alternative locations for the proposed facility. To date, staff has not received any additional information to that effect from Verizon, and Verizon is in fact requesting a second continuance. The reason this time is because their attorney has a scheduling conflict and was not able to attend today's hearing. So staff is recommending that you either continue the hearing to September 27th, and I have checked with the applicant and that date does work for the scheduling of their team, or alternatively, staff does have a presentation for you on this project, and we're able to present the project in the event that your board wants to continue the hearing.
Well, let me see where we're at. I'm of the mind to continue, though I do understand there are members of the community here who are somewhat frustrated in having to travel continuously for this. I'm not in the mood to continue more than one more. I mean, this is it. I think on the 27th we have a hearing, whether they have an attorney present or not. This is where I'm leaning.
Let me ask staff if I could. In the report, there was a suggestion that they continue to work on a alternatives analysis, which did seem to be lacking in the initial submission. Do you have any information as to the nature of their work at this point?
No, I haven't received any additional information since the Planning Commission hearing. I do understand that the applicant is still continuing to work on the alternatives analysis. So that might be another secondary reasoning behind the request for a continuance.
Are we going to open it to the...
We will do that regardless of...
That's all my questions at this point.
Okay. So we'll look forward to continuance, but open it up to the public?
Well,
have to have Mr. Singwald make a whole presentation that we won't need to hear.
Would it be reasonable to hear from the applicant as to the nature? I know the applicant agent
is the applicant's
here.
Agent here?
And,
okay.
The agent could talk to the...
Okay, let's...
To the alternatives analysis.
Please. Are you the, if you wouldn't mind, I'm sorry, I don't have your
Trisha
slip.
Yes, speaker slip.
Your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Trisha Knight, representing Verizon Wireless. We are actively pursuing multiple candidates, and there is one candidate that may prove to be most promising for us, an alternate candidate. However, there are some construction costs for the road that we would like to meet with CAL FIRE to determine exactly what road improvements they would require for that. So this appeal might actually be withdrawn. We just need a little bit more time to nail down the details. There's not telephone that's readily available to this site, so we would need to look at a microwave path. So there's just some details that we're not quite clear on yet. So we just were asking for one more continuance, and I understand the 27th would be the last option to do so.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. Can you assure us that you'll have that information by September 27th?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we have the power to insure them, so that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I will open it up to speakers anyway, but I'm assuming we'll look towards the continuance
on
the 27th.
I'm leaning for continuance, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, I will understandably, some folks are frustrated, but we will hear from them nonetheless and look at the 27th as the day we will have the hearing one way or another. Randy Gray, followed by Larry McNamee, are the two requests I have to speak. Three? Okay, I'm missing one then. You'll come after Mr. McNamee. Then.
Hi, good afternoon, Board of Supervisors and colleagues. My name is Randy Gray. I reside at 1760 Ironwood Place, which is directly below the proposed cell site. I was one of the originals that was notified during the original series and process and permitting and all that. I come to you today, and I just ask that you would, you know, the two options today was to give a continuance or to deny the project, and I just come to you today to ask that you would altogether just deny this project in its current location. Based on the Planning Commission's already denial, based on the Templeton Advisory Group's, the TAG, the rescinding of their original approval of the project, and on behalf of the neighbors in the surrounding neighborhood. You know, we talked about alternative sites, and that's where I'm a little bit confused in this. If this project is proposed in its current site, and now that we are seeking possible other locations, I don't understand why we have to continue this without denying the project in its current location under its current specifications, and therefore let Verizon continue to seek other sites. I'm a public school teacher. I start school this week. My wife works locally here in the community as well. And like you said, I am a bit frustrated. I have the freedom to come to you today. On the 27th, I can't say I have that same freedom. And just being kind of strung along like this again and again and again is tedious. And you know, in the past, we've expressed our issues with the project in its current location. But I don't think that's what it's about today. You've read those documents. I believe you've seen those emails. Today, I'm just asking you to do what's right. You know, let's let Verizon continue to seek a new location. But as its current location and the current plan, I'd ask that you'd make your decision today and deny the current project as is written. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Mr. McNamee, followed by Mr. Rubin.
Board of Supervisors, thank you for serving the County of San Luis Obispo. We ask you to deny Verizon's request to appeal Planning Commission decision to deny this project. We ask that the continuance be denied. There are numerous better sites. There is no reason to continue this site. It is a bad location. The community is against it. Templeton Advisory Group denied it, the Planning Commission denied it, and we urge that the Board of Supervisors deny it also. I've been a real estate agent for over 16 years. I am president-elect of the Atascadero Association of Realtors. I'm state director for California Association of Realtors. I sold 61 homes in the adjacent project. It is my opinion this will negatively affect property values. There are many better locations, and I volunteer to help Verizon find a suitable alternate site. Prior to my career in real estate, I worked in the electronics industry for over 17 years with progressive experience as a technician, engineer, and manager. The water tower blocks these RF signals, making it necessary to have multiple antennas. This is an unsafe and poor location. This is a quiet rural neighborhood. On a summer evening, you can hear a conversation up the street. Verizon indicated the facility would produce 65 dB of noise. An air conditioning unit produces 60 dB of noise. The freeway produces 70 dB of noise. I have summarized my views in writing for the board. As we said before, there are numerous alternate sites. Why beat this one to death? The community keeps coming back over and over again. Initially, Verizon did not want to continue the Planning Commission. We requested a continuance because the neighborhood had not been properly notified. Verizon didn't want to do that because they felt they were at an advantage because the neighborhood wasn't well represented. and now they've asked for two continuances to serve their interests. Just to summarize, I think there's a pattern here. The community's against it. TAG is against it. The Planning Commission denied it, and I would urge you to deny it and deny the request for a continuance. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Rubin?
Thank you, Gary Rubin. I appreciate your service to the community, members of the board and county staff and county council. I'm asking that you deny the request for a continuance. Two reasons were set forth in Ms. Knight's letter regarding the need for continuance. One is that the attorney could not be here. I noticed the attorney letter that was posted on the website. It was written back in April after the Planning Commission's decision, and two other attorneys were copied on that letter. Three members of the bar represent Verizon. The two who are copied are in-house attorneys, and one who is writing the letters from San Francisco. I am wondering, if one attorney couldn't make it, why couldn't one of the other attorneys make it? And I'm wondering why, if the attorneys thought it was necessary for them to be here and it was important for them to be here, why any one of them would not have written a letter directly to the Board of Supervisors saying, I have a conflict, I couldn't be here. The second issue brought up for a reason for continuance is that Verizon would like additional time to search and look at the options presented by the neighbors. This process started, I believe, over 2 years ago. It was incumbent on the applicant to search for other properties during that two-year process. And then in April, when the Planning Commission denied the application, in part because of a lack of a search for other locations, as required by the county ordinance, again, nothing has been done since then that we can see any evidence of that there has been any search actually been conducted, and that's been 4 months. Even if there is a search now ongoing, which we see no evidence of, it could lead to one of two results. One result is another location is found that they determine is economically suitable, and they move forward with that, and they withdraw their appeal. No harm is done in that option if you deny the request today. The only possible harm that they may propose could occur if you deny a request today is that they were not able to find any other location, and therefore this location is suitable. I argue it's still not suitable, even if they can't find another location, as was indicated by the Planning Commission and as was noted in your findings, proposed findings, in the proposed resolution that was drafted by county staff and or county council. So I ask you to deny the request today. It's hard to say no, but they've had plenty of time. I'm also a public school teacher. I'm a full-time faculty member at Cuesta. I started teaching yesterday. I may not be able to be here next month. This is directly across the street from my house. We found out about it in March. We did ask them if they would continue it. They chose not to. Now they're asking again for continuances. The process has been abused. And I'm asking that you just move forward today because it is inconsistent with the general plan because of the visual impacts, the noise impact, the wildlife impacts, as noted in the proposed findings. I ask that you deny this request for continuance and adopt the proposed resolution that was posted online to deny the application. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Mr. Gibson or Mr. Patterson, did you?
Defer to Mr. Patterson.
Yeah, I have a question for County Council. Appeal issue number three, on page C36, it stated that the Telecommunications Act, if it prevents a wireless provider from closing a significant gap in service by the least intrusive means, do we have any evidence that there's a existing gap in service? And if we move forward with the hearing and deny this, are we not giving the applicant the ability to address the issue that they raised relative to the Telecommunications Act and the gap that does occur in service currently?
Thank you. This is Whitney McDonald from County Council. Those are good questions, and I don't believe we have received evidence of a significant gap in coverage. Typically, those are supplied through what they call propagation studies, which show which areas have dropped calls and issues like that. And I think staff could probably answer for sure whether or not we've received one, and I don't believe we have here. Whether or not continuing this item would foreclose their ability to supply it, it would if the board took an action to deny the project today. However, they've always had an opportunity to submit that evidence to us, and because the Telecommunications Act is the governing law that requires that a significant gap in coverage be shown, it really is their duty to provide us that evidence. And the courts have actually analyzed this issue in pretty good detail and come up with some specific standards and sets out a burden-shifting requirement. So it is their obligation to establish a gap in coverage in order to then, you know, claim that if we deny the project, it would, in effect, be a prohibition of services.
Mr. Singelwald, do you have?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald.
Yeah, Erlen Singelwald, County Planning. Actually, Verizon has submitted a radio frequency propagation map. Now, I can't say whether or not that proves a significant gap in coverage. I think that's ultimately a question that would be debated, you know, in the federal courts, if, you know, we were sued by Verizon for denying the project. I do know on this particular project that the objective isn't so much to close a gap in coverage, but it's to increase capacity. Mm-hmm. I believe actually their coverage map showed adequate coverage. Whether or not denying a project that would increase capacity would be an effective prohibition of service, I don't know if that's been determined yet by the courts. So.
And maybe Ms. McDonald could address that question.
Actually, that is a good question, and the courts have not come down definitively on that issue. There has been one case that has just sort of raised it, but because it didn't need to be decided in that case, they haven't gone there yet.
Okay, thank you very much. Given the circumstances, I'm inclined to move forward with a hearing and make a determination today. I think Verizon has had ample opportunity to provide the information that is typically provided in a situation like this, and they simply haven't done it. And they knew a month ago that we continued the hearing to this date and should have made provisions to have someone here. So I'm inclined to move forward with the hearing.
Ms. Gibson?
Mr. Chairman, this is a tough one. Let me first say I certainly sympathize with members of the public who had spent their time to come down and sit through other issues before we got to this one, especially those for whom academic years are going to start here pretty soon. I will also say that over my history in land use regulation in this county, wireless carriers do not have a great record of being timely and forthcoming with certain information that needs to be here before us before we make a decision. That said, this board has always given a certain amount of leeway to both sides of land use issues. And we have continued, and on very rare occasions have we conducted a hearing when a continuance has been requested. I think in particular the alternatives analysis is an important piece of information that we need. If this resolves this particular appeal, that's great, and that might be the simple way to go. If Verizon chooses to pursue this appeal, that and alternatives analysis is something that I, for one, am going to be looking very carefully at, because it's actually a requirement of our land use ordinance that in making the findings to approve a new wireless communications facility, that we need to have looked at the potential of co-location on other existing facilities, and we need to look at an alternatives analysis that show us that this is a necessary place to be. So with reluctance and with the understanding that this is it, I will move we continue this matter to September 27.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Teixeira, did you want a second? Please. Second by Supervisor Teixeira. And I agree with Supervisor Gibson. I think, you know, and I certainly sympathize with the folks who came out to speak, and they will be able to submit, if they cannot make it, their comments to us. That will be part of the record. I think it is one of those difficult situations where when we're in our quasi-judicial role, we need to sometimes bend over backwards to make sure that due process is completely afforded, whether we can tell whether the appellant is totally acting in good faith is really not a judgment we can make. So we are going to decide on September 27, 2011. We will have a hearing then, and I think that's just the best way to go about it. So with that, Madam Clerk, I think we have a voice vote to continue it to September 27, 2001. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, Supervisor Patterson opposed.
And the motion was to September 27th, 2011, I hope.
2011, right, sorry.
Or we need a DeLorean or something like
okay.
that.
Do we have that, Madam Clerk? Okay. All right, thank you. We will now be adjourning until next Tuesday, August 23rd. We'll see you then.